And this is Karen Brewster, and today is May 1st, 2019, and I'm here with Dave Snow at his home in Erie, Colorado. And this is for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. So Dave, thank you for letting me come see you today.
Well, thank you for coming.
Yeah, and we hope the upstairs rest of your family stays quiet.
Well they should. If they don't, we'll take another run up.
Okay. There. You did historical architecture work for the Park Service related to Skagway.
Yes.
Starting in what year?
It actually started before 1980. Okay. I worked for the Denver Service Center, and when I was there, we worked on projects all over the country, and Klondike just happened to be one of the projects. I did the historic structure report on the Mascot Saloon, and it was just going up there a lot. Mm-hmm. And essentially I was on the road so much that I thought maybe I should just live up there. And so that's kind of what we did. I really hadn't been in the Park Service that long. I was a GS-7, and I love adventure, but I also had a family and two little kids. I had, a four-year-old and a baby.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really a traumatic move, as it turned out, but we made the move.
So what year did you move to Alaska?
That would be 1980.
Okay. And I'm going to take us back a little bit in your life.
Okay.
So we know a little bit about you.
Okay.
Where you're from, where you grew up, your education, how you ended up with the Park Service.
Well, I was born in Denver, Colorado, and I had a pretty normal, childhood. We lived out in Jefferson County near a golden place called Applewood, and went to Wheat Ridge High School. And then the Vietnam War came, and I think that essentially I wanted to leave home. A young man wanted to get out, seek adventure, and that was part of why I joined the Navy. I also felt that if I went in the Navy, I wouldn't get stuck going to Vietnam, as I would have been drafted had I not joined. As it turned out, I went to Vietnam twice anyway. And I was over on the a tributary of the Mekong River, and then I was on the USS Hancock. So about 2 years of my life, either in or near Vietnam. And then after I got out, I went to school on the GI Bill. We lived in San Diego, because that's where I got out of the Navy. Mm-hmm. And I got my first 2 years of college free, because in those days it was free down there. It was really a great deal. And they had an architectural program in the two-year college that was down there. And so I did that, and then I transferred up to Pomona, California Polytechnic University. And
not Pomona College.
Not Pomona College. It's like Cal Poly. There's Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and then there's Cal Poly Pomona.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And they both have architectural programs. The one in Pomona had just started, and a guy named Al Cappy was running that. And it was, a very, very beginning type thing. And so you had to be interviewed to even get into the college. It wasn't really a money thing as much as it was just pure competition. So you had to be, the 2 years I spent in the junior college was very beneficial, because I had learned how to draw and things like that. So I got into that college, and then it was 4 years there. Mm-hmm. And then after I got out of college with my architectural, I had a Bachelor of Science in Architecture, and I did very well in school. And I was going to, go out and just, take the world, as most young people in college, after they get out of college. And I eventually got a job back in Denver. We were living in Los Angeles at the time, and I got a job back to Denver, and I took it, and we moved back back home.
And what year would that have been?
That would have been about 1976 or so, or 75, somewhere around in there. I think I graduated theoretically in 76, but and I, because I went into the Park Service in 77.
Okay.
It was pretty quick. I wasn't in that firm for very long.
The job in Denver was with a private architectural firm?
Right, Syracuse Lawler and Associates. And it was a good job, but it didn't pay very well. It was like $5 an hour, you know. And it's like, I was lucky to even get a job in those days. And so I kept kind of looking for jobs, and this one job came out that said you'd work for 10 months and you'd take a furlough for two.
Mm-hmm.
And I made more money working 10 months a year for this job than I would be staying at the firm. And this was with the Park Service. And there was also another job that I almost took with the Army Corps of Engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was up in Fairbanks or someplace. And then another one in Montana. So I kept getting all these jobs to move north. But as it turned out, I took the one with the Park Service. And I came to
So that was the Denver Service Center?
Denver Service Center. Mm-hmm. And I worked for a guy named Harold LaFleur.
How do you spell that?
LaFleur.
Okay.
LaFleur.
And what does the Denver Service Center do? I don't know if it's... Does it still exist?
Yes.
Okay.
In those days, it was a design... It was the design arm of the entire Park Service. They did all the major... visitor centers, restorations, you name it. So, and it was part of the bicentennial program. So
mm-hmm.
they hired like 30 architects right out of school.
Wow.
And I considered myself pretty much right out of school. I'd only been in that firm for probably less than a year. So I took that job, and the first thing I knew, I was working up at Paradise Inn in Washington. Doing the historic structure report on that. And
is that in North Cascades?
Yeah, it's up Mount Rainier.
Oh, Mount Rainier, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, to give some context to this, I had absolutely no training in historic architecture. Okay, they were hiring architects right off the street. They didn't care if you had the background or not, and they would train you. And I got trained. You know, it was a really neat learning environment. We had one... old fellow there, Frank Gerner, he'd gone to school during the Beaux-Arts period. I mean, he was that old.
What's that?
It's a period of architecture when they did classical columns and things like that. And, he was drawing ink on linen. We were doing ink on paper. I mean, it was everything was hand-drawn in those
right.
days. So it was like working at a super architectural firm. Yeah, it was really a good fit for me. So.
And so what kind of training did the Park Service provide you?
It was on the job. And that's typically
the
way it is in an architectural firm. You get out of school and you think you know everything, and then you learn the real stuff when you start working. And it was the same way with the Park Service. So not only was I learning architecture, you know, from a practical sense, but I was learning preservation architecture. And I think Harold... my boss, mm-hmm. he was very good at it, and he'd been there for quite some time. And it's just a whole bunch of guys that had been, you know, the Park Service had been doing, like architectural, landscape architecture design since the 1930s.
Oh, really?
So they, you know, they had quite a, kind of an experience at it, you know, mm-hmm. so I felt like part of a new club, you know. it was a good feeling, and
yeah.
I had a good rapport with everybody, and the work was the funnest I'd ever done in my life. I mean, you just go to all these parks, you look at old buildings, you draw them, you measure them, and learn how to, you know, restore them, and you learn how to work with historians, archaeologists,
mm-hmm.
engineers. You know, and that was the neat thing about the service center, that all those disciplines were there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a couple years of that was really beneficial for what later was to become with Skagway, because I had a really good working relationship with all the different disciplines of engineering. I understood compliance. I understood, you know, all the things that I needed to you know, I'd been exposed to a lot. Because mm-hmm. once I dropped into Skagway, it was just me.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, how do you learn that preservation part? Because it's sort of a very specific discipline.
Well, it's you walk, for example, you walk through a building with somebody that's been doing it for a number of years. They point things out to you. You know, this is such and such. You know, the reason this wood is still there is because it's first growth wood, and you know, all of those just real basic things. You know, and of course, back in those days, we didn't have computers or anything, so everything was very visceral.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would do paint tests by scraping and looking. It wasn't real scientific, but you know, there was a connection to some more scientific stuff, but I would say that the lean of the office was more towards a practical architectural approach, because you know, we had schedules to meet, we had budgets to meet, and it was important to understand that, because you couldn't just milk the cow forever, although there were people that did,
yeah.
You know, as in any job. But I was pretty adventuresome, and the more difficult, the more challenging, the more remote. I looked at fortifications from South Carolina all the way down to the Dry Tortugas, you know.
Wow.
And in those days, we would go out for weeks, you know, either looking at buildings or measuring them, studying them, researching them. And then we would work with, we had a lot of old-time historians that we worked with that, you know, were incredible people.
And those historians were in the parks, or they were in the service center?
They were in the service center, actually. Yeah, they, most of my world before Skagway was very centered at the Denver Service Center.
Well, I find it interesting that Denver Service Center covered the whole U.S. It wasn't just the western region.
Right. I mean, there was, within the service center itself, it kind of went through, you know, sometimes we'd have portions, you know, you'd have a group that would work just in the east, and, you know, and it was that way when I left, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But I moved around. I've worked on all sorts of, well, I can get to that later.
Okay.
But when I came back to the service center, I did, you know, a lot more stuff. So
Harold is who hired you and who you worked directly for?
Well, Harold was my supervisor, the guy that hired me. His name escapes me right now.
That's okay. So I was wondering who else worked in the office and who you worked with and for. So it was Harold. You said Frank was...
Well, there was Frank Gerner, but then you know, I had just about everybody that came in during those times. I knew them. You know, Paul Cloyd came a little later, but I worked with him some. Randy, boy, all these names.
Yeah.
I knew a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I was thinking, if there was any people in particular that, you know, helped you in those early days?
Well, I think it was mainly Harold. Doug Ashley was there. He was he worked with me, and he was an experienced architect, and I worked with Doug quite a bit. But a lot of times it would be just me and Harold going out to do a job, and that's how I learned, because it was like a one-on-one tutorial.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very good, and I like to write, so that was another thing. I didn't do much of it before the Park Service, but once I got in Park Service, I started writing these reports, and there was a lot of technical narrative that I didn't realize I could do.
And again, you sort of learned on the job. Huh?
I learned on the job.
They don't teach you that in architectural school?
Well, back when I went to architectural, there was no historic preservation programs that I was aware of. You know, it was you learned contemporary architecture, and I learned very contemporary architecture when I went to school, but and my mind was still open, you know. Even though in school it was the international style, and that's what we were kind of pushed toward. Once I got out, it was like, you know, what is this historic preservation? You know, what is this? And I had a completely open, I was like a sponge. I just took it all in, and that's how I learned it. And it was, you know, you go out to parks and you talk to the maintenance people and you find out the practicalities of things and the problems they were having. And sometimes I was just as ignorant as they were, but you learn.
Yeah. You know. Oh, you were how old at this point?
I was about 30.
Okay. Yeah. So you said young and early in your career.
Yeah. I came in as a GS-5.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have a master's degree or anything. I just had a Bachelor of Science. But I didn't want to put myself in more school and more debt, you know.
And how were projects assigned at the service center? Like, how is it that you ended up working at Paradise Inn versus you got assigned to Skagway?
Well, you know, I think they just, if you needed something to do, they had a list of projects. And, you know, if you were capable of doing it, you would be put on it. And, you know, early on, like Harold would be the lead on the project. I would be assisting him. But later on, I started doing my own projects, mm-hmm. you know. And like they say, well, write a historic structure report. And I'd never even heard of one before. Mm-hmm. And but I just, you know, plunged into it and learned how to do it. And so anyway, that between doing a lot of field work, a lot of writing, I was building up a pretty good reputation, mm-hmm. you know, by the time, say, 1980 rolled around, and I was traveling up to Alaska a lot, because we had the Russian Bishop's House going on, and we had mm-hmm. Klondike going on, and my friend Randy Conrad, he was working on the Russian Bishop's House, and I was, you know, kind of working, I was really interested in Klondike, because I thought it was just really, really neat. I mean, it was in terrible condition, but it was like, I could see the potential. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of, you know, I told my wife, I said, you know, maybe if we move up there, I won't be traveling all the time. The work will be right there. And that was kind of what was in my mind. Mm-hmm. Bill Brown, I met him up on site. I don't know how Bill's doing these days.
He's not alive anymore.
Yeah, I kind of, he was.
It's a recent last couple of years, I think.
Yeah, he and I were pretty close at that time, and he kind of talked me into it, to be honest with you. He said, Dave, you gotta just come up here. And so I did. And
you moved to Anchorage?
No, I moved straight to Skagway.
Oh, you actually moved to Skagway, okay.
See, the part of the thing in my mind, I had been in the Park Service long enough, I'd been to enough parks and stuff, that I knew that if I went up there, I wanted to stay an architect. You know, I was worried that if I became park staff, they would siphon me off into a whole bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do the projects. And that was probably the smartest thing I ever did.
Yeah.
Because the superintendent, he really wanted me in a uniform, and he wanted me to be in the maintenance department. You know, he was a traditional guy.
And it was this Dick Sims at the time?
Mm-hmm. And Dick Hoffman had been up there before him. And Dick Sims replaced him, and Gary Higgins, an architect from the service center, had been up there, and he was living up there, but he had some issues, and I had to suddenly leave town. So it was like this vacuum, you know, there was a new superintendent, the past historical architect was gone, and they just didn't really have any technical expertise. You know, they had a lot of, you know, Jay Cable was the chief ranger, who's a good friend of mine, and but he didn't know anything about historic buildings. Mm-hmm. And they tended to hire people into this historic park that didn't have, you know, the background in preservation. Mm-hmm. But be it as it may, I just jumped right into it. And of course, there's no place to live in Skagway, right. And that was the first problem. And so I had to kind of negotiate my way to, you know, I told him, I said, I'll live in anywhere. It's just, we have to find a place. And the park wasn't real cooperative with me. They just figured, you'll figure it out. And I finally told him, I'll live in the Moore House. The Moore House is the oldest house in Skagway, and nothing had been done to it in like 50 years. Mm-hmm. But that's where I moved into.
With your family?
With my family. And It had no heat, okay. It had nothing.
No running water.
It barely had running water. The sewer was plugged. Everything was, you know, it hadn't been lived in. Like,
I'm surprised they let you live in it as a historic building.
Well, you gotta remember the times.
That's true.
They, you know, if you go back a little bit, Pete Bathurst, I think that was his name, he had went into the Peniel Mission and done a bunch of work.
Oh, really?
So he could live there. There just wasn't any place to live.
Right. Well, it's still a problem.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is.
And, you know, in some parks, you know, they provide housing for park employees, but in Skagway, that's not an option, I guess.
Well, they had a trailer for the superintendent. I don't know if they still have that or not, but it was, you know, I just told him, I says, we'll move in there. We won't do anything to it. We'll just live in there, and we'll do what we have to stabilize the house.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we had them put a roof on it. But it was really rough. You know, there was no insulation in it. And yeah. We met this couple, Frank and, let's see, what was his name? Sylvia. I can't remember the guy's name. Anyway, we met a couple, and they sort of adopted us like grandparents. Mm-hmm. They liked our kids. He taught me how to build a barrel stove. And that's how I heated that thing, you know. And it was... This was going on before I really got into any of the work, because I had to have a place to live. I had to have a place for my family. And the town was not real cooperative with Park Service. They didn't like the Park Service real well.
Yeah.
And but we dug our heels in, and we finally actually were able to kind of live in that house.
So
during the summertime.
Right. So who paid for the improvements? Like you said, the roof needed fixing.
The Park Service paid for it, because I made sure that whatever we did would be to stabilize it, you know, like putting a roof on it or something. We didn't make, contrary to how the Peniel Mission was treated, we didn't do anything in there that would have really improved it just for me.
Right.
Other than just stabilizing it, and because I knew what, you know, I knew what the ultimate goal was.
Right.
And I didn't see that as a permanent solution. And as it was, I could not live there in the wintertime. So I had to move into the Peniel Mission after not, you know, after the first summer, because it had heat. And even at that, it was kind of a fire trap, because they had done a lot of work in there, but not good work.
Right.
You know?
But it was already owned by the Park Service at that point?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, they had spent a lot of their resources fixing that house up previously, rather than working on stuff that I felt
fixing which
more.
House? The Moore
the
House?
Peniel.
The Peniel. Okay.
Yeah, the Peniel Mission. And there was nothing really done to it to help it, to preserve it, you know. You know, when you're doing all interior finishes, that's not really the same thing. So anyway, we lived there for a period of time. I'm going to go through the housing thing first before I...
No, sure, yeah, no, this is great.
Because
housing is an issue, so that's good.
It was a big issue.
Yeah.
And it got to the point where we weren't happy in the Peniel Mission either. And we didn't have the best relationship with the superintendent and his wife, because they didn't like the fact that I was a regional employee instead of a park employee.
Okay.
So they weren't doing much to really help us. So I finally decided, I'm going to go find a house in Skagway, and I'm going to buy it. So I tried to do that. There was a house available, called the Gault House, G-A-U-L-T.
Okay.
They used to call it the White Pass House, mainly because the White Pass owned it. So I went after that, and I ran into a wall, because the local White Pass guys didn't want a Park Service person living in that house.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife went up and talked to the guys in Canada. We went over their head,
mm-hmm.
and they sold us that house. In spite of what the local people wanted.
Wow.
And so I bought that house, and it was a really nice house. Jim Hamilton had owned it previously. He used to either run or I think he used to own Kermsey's. And he had taken the newel post out of the railroad depot and put it in that house.
He taken the what?
The newel post. They had a,
what's that?
It's a post for a stair.
Oh, okay.
It's really nice, and it was historic. He took it out of the admin building of the railroad and put it in his house.
Wow.
So one of the things I did was take that and give it back to the Park Service. But anyway, I had, at least we finally had a house to live in.
Now, where is that house?
It's on 6th and Alaska.
Okay.
And it was easy to sell because the woman asked me when we left Skagway, she says, "Is that house haunted?" I said, "You bet it is." She said, "I'll buy it." That was a big thing in Skagway. When I lived in the Pinal Mission, nobody would babysit my kids.
Oh, really?
Because they felt it was haunted. You know, there's a lot of that ghost stories that go around there.
Yeah.
And I had a few experiences myself that I'm not so sure there isn't some stuff going on there, but anyway. So anyhow, we had good housing there.
So did that gulp house have to be fixed up? Did you work?
No, it was actually, I had to paint it. It was the only thing I did to it. Mm-hmm. It was in beautiful, it had been lived in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things that are lived in are easier to come in. The Pinal Mission had been lived in, but the work that was done made it a very dangerous, it had an oil heater in it, which would catch fire. And then and it had a wood stove that was not really, in the wintertime, the north wall would ice up in that house, even with the heat going full blast. Yeah, on the Pinal Mission.
Yeah.
It was not an easy place to heat, even with a heater. And so that was another reason I wanted out. And I just wanted it away from the Park Service thing, because Dick wanted to control my life, and I didn't want him to, and I didn't want him to, I just needed that kind of separation. So I tried to maintain that firewall between me and the park because it was really a much healthier thing. As if I slipped into being a park employee and working for the park, then many of the decisions that I would have made otherwise would have been made by the superintendent. And they weren't good preservation decisions. So this way it gave me some autonomy. Occasionally, John Cook had to come down and straighten things out, but it helped.
Mm-hmm.
And
John Cook's role was?
He was the regional director at the time.
Okay. So the fact that you were still a Denver...
I was a regional employee.
Well, you were no longer Denver Service Center.
Right. See, here's the irony. I moved up there so I wouldn't have to travel so much. Well, after I got up there, it was a little bit of a bait and switch because... They say, you're in Skagway. Well, now you can be the regional architect, too.
Mm.
So in addition to all the work I had in Skagway, they wanted me to fly around to all the other parks in Alaska and do things. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
But most of 90% of what my work was for that 4 years, from 1980 to 1984, was in Skagway on the structures there.
Now, how were you able to work that, to come from Denver Service Center and get a position in Skagway? Was it an open position for the historical architect? Or?
Yeah, they had an open position there. Gary Higgins was in it.
Mm-hmm.
But I told him I wouldn't go up there if I had to work for the park. I knew enough to not get
But
caught.
Somehow they created a position
Well, and I think that's why they made me go to the other parks, because that's how they justified it.
Okay.
So I was a regional employee living in a park.
Right.
And they weren't real happy about it. I mean, one person, I got along with everybody, but...
The superintendent, And what about, the community you were talking about, they were not very happy to have Park Service people there. And
well, they'd been burned, and I can tell you why. I understand it completely now. And at the time, I was beginning to understand it, but I didn't totally understand it. The town is a national landmark.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, previous superintendent Dick Hoffman had led people to believe that he could control what people did to their houses.
Mm.
Okay, and it really unnerved a lot of the people in town. They just because they're in a national historic, I've learned since really don't have to follow. You can do whatever the heck you want. Unless you've got federal money involved in it. And But that was the perception, you know. The perception was that the Park Service had control of everybody's house, and that didn't sit well with people.
No, it wouldn't.
You know, and they would lend equipment, you know. There was an agreement where we would lend jacks and stuff to homeowners, but it should have been just left at that. You know, you shouldn't have been able to go in and tell people what to do. But that was the presiding presumption.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working against that a lot when I was there.
And did Dick Sims continue that?
Yes, he did. You know, and I think he, after he had been there a while, I think he was starting to figure it out. But he was so traditional, so kind of old school about things. It really wasn't in his nature to make that change, you know. And I mean, I had some big battles there. There was West Tours was in there with their hotels. They painted all their buildings black and red, all of them. And so they wanted me to design a compatible structure, and I did. And I said, you know, you should change the color scheme on the rest of your buildings. And we went back and forth. They brought in their architects and stuff. And in the end, they decided to do that. But I didn't know at the time that the governor of Alaska, and I don't even remember who it was at the time, had a lot of vested interest in West Tours. And I guess I made a lot of ripples that went all the way to Anchorage when we made that color change.
Sheffield?
He was Might have been.
Hickle or Sheffield?
Yeah. Anyway, I just know that I got my way. But at some price, politically up the ladder. But you know, in those days, I felt like I could do anything. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of doing what it took to make the town change. And one of the ideas I had, and John Cook said he had an idea, but we may have had the idea at the same time. I don't know, but I felt that we should just start painting buildings. We had done some color testing. We knew what the historic colors were. And I told the park that we should just paint the buildings, even though it's probably going to, you know, a lot of stuff will get replaced and repainted. But we need to show them a different appearance so that they can kind of get used to how things might be in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started doing that. We started painting all these weathering buildings, all these really bright colors. Oh, the town just went crazy. They thought, you're turning this into Coney Island, you know. Mm-hmm. And that I heard that a million times. But in the end, it really kind of helped open their minds to historic preservation. Because I told them, it probably did look like Coney Island back in the Gold Rush. It was bright, flashy.
Yeah.
You know, there was all sorts of illegal things going on. It was a crazy place, you know. And
yeah, I wouldn't have thought that they painted buildings in the Gold Rush time.
Oh, yeah.
I would have thought they were just plain wood.
No, well, in the really early, you know, you have to remember the Gold Rush was over by the time they built these things.
Oh, right.
You know, the Gold Rush was like a flash in the pan.
And that was tense, a lot of that stuff, yeah.
And like Dyea never got to the point where they probably painted anything.
Right.
But Skagway, you know, they were expecting big things there. They had the railroad, I think,
right,
which drove a lot of things. And there was lots. And I've got some things on paint I'll tell you after when we get to it. But that was kind of one of the early things that I did, is I made sure that they knew we were coming.
And the buildings that you painted, those were the ones already owned by the Park Service?
They were park
buildings. Didn't just go paint the whole downtown?
It's not that there weren't some people that thought I should,
mm-hmm,
because of that perception that we had all this control over everything. But you know, I kept right on to the buildings that we owned. And I started trying to make some inroads with the locals. I hired locals.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hired them, they didn't like to follow any kind of construction rules. They didn't want to work in the wintertime. And I knew that if we did not work in the wintertime, we would never leave. I would never finish. So I started a program where we would work in the winter. The Park Service is really not set up for that because it's more seasonal hiring.
Right.
So I worked the system. I'd get more people during the summer because it was easier to get them. And then I tried to get other people, like we would even steal the trail crew and use them, because we were lifting buildings. We just needed, we needed strong guys. Mm-hmm. And
So that would have been like Roy Nelson and Jerry Watson.
You bet. Yeah. I know those guys real well. Jerry, he was a Vietnam vet. He was a corpsman.
Mm-hmm. I just interviewed him the other day.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll talk about that later. But okay, anyway, those were the kind of guys that you hired.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get them on there and they're turning these bars to lift the building and they're bending the bars, you know. They're so strong. But so I went after any resource I could find, and I started kind of developing a rapport with people. That's not to say there weren't some people that weren't, you know, they wanted to homestead some of the jobs. And, you know, homesteading is when somebody works kind of purposely real slow so that they don't lose their job. Mm-hmm. You know, and you have to kind of get, Alaska has some of that. I don't know if it's just Alaska, but it's maybe the remoteness, the remote areas where people, they like it there, they want to stay there, they want to keep their work. But for me, it was, I had a budget, I had to meet deadlines, I had to show progress. Mm-hmm. And the buildings were in terrible condition, some of the worst condition of any buildings I've ever seen. The only thing that kept them standing is the fact that they had been built with first growth lumber. And in the early days in Skagway, the tide would come down Broadway.
Wow.
Because it wasn't until World War II that they built it out and stopped the tide from coming in.
They brought in all that fill material.
Yeah. So before that, those buildings would sit there and the railroad and everything, and there'd be water coming in.
So up to what, like fourth the tide would come that far on a
high tide? My theory is where my house was on 6th, there were some really neat buildings on 6th, and it went the other axis. Mm-hmm. I really think that was the beginning of Skagway, and then when the railroad came, they changed the axis down Broadway, you know, and then they had to deal with the tide. But I think originally they were smart, they kept out of the water,
right?
Because the farther back you got, the higher you got.
Right, and Moore built his house at what is now 5th, right?
Yeah, it was probably, I don't know if it was high enough, but, you know, those buildings had no foundations.
Oh, really?
They had wood foundations, right. Treated wood. They had foundations, right. But it wasn't what you and I would think is a traditional masonry foundation.
Right, and they didn't dig down in.
Right. You know, that worked on the buildings over the years, and so that had a lot to do with why they were settling And I mean, to tell you, they were settling.
Well, I think those logs eventually would start rotting out if they're just sitting on the ground.
Well, if they stay wet, you know, they probably did fine for a period of time. When they stayed wet, when the tide kept coming in and out, they were probably fine. Oh. So when the Corps of Engineers went in and stopped it from coming in, then they dried out.
Oh.
That's when I think deterioration started to happen.
Oh, interesting. I would have thought the other way around.
Well, keeping something wet, it keeps its integrity.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So, you know, all the buildings had foundation issues, major foundation mm-hmm. issues. And
you said first growth lumber. Can you explain why that is better?
Well, first growth means that the tree grew naturally. And so, if you look at a piece of first growth, the growth rings are real close together. You know, that's why wood shingles used to last a long time. They used to use first growth wood for shingles. They don't anymore. And so now you get 10 years on wood shingles. So if you got spring wood and winter wood, and the winter wood is what gives it its strength. You know, if it's a fertilized tree, you'll see great big fat wide rings where it's been fertilized. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make such a strong tree. But all that first growth wood is, even the buildings that were left in Dyea, there was still something standing out there. But
anyway. So those were built out of local trees then that were cut down and
you know, I don't know.
Lumber made them?
I've seen pictures of Skagway where there's no trees around it, so I know they cut them down.
Right.
Whether they used them, you know, a lot of the lumber that was used in this was, it looked like it might have been shipped up for some of those buildings.
But it could still have been first growth, but was lumber shipped in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because just back in those days, I mean, lumber was just better.
Right.
period, no matter where you build.
Okay.
And same with the siding and every all of that. So anyway, so the program I started in Skagway was to stabilize all the buildings and restore the depot and admin building. That was basically my goal, and to do it within 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a crew working on painting a lot of times and just jacking buildings up, straightening them out, putting roofs, you know, just doing things that would keep the weather out of them. The problem was, of course, the underpinning. And when I got there, they had done some of this. The Lynch Kennedy, they had that was up on wood,
like blocks or
lintels.
Something?
Well, no, it was.
What are lintels?
Well, they went up. It was timbers, I should say, the proper terminology. They used spruce. Because there's not a lot of good wood up in Canada and stuff. You know, mm-hmm. It's not like oak.
Right.
It's spruce. It's strong and it's light, but it rots easy. So we had the Lynch Kennedy up on. They had left it. It had scaffolding in there and jacks and spruce, and that's the way it was just sitting there.
But so it was raised up off the ground.
It was raised up off the ground because everybody knew that the foundations were not much. And it got so hard for me to find a way to heat my house, I eventually had to make a deal with the Park Service where I could get some of that wood and chop it up and put it in the wood stove. So,
if you took the timbers from under the Lynch and Kennedy?
Well, we had to replace it with something else.
Yeah, what did you use instead?
Well, we used jacks.
Okay.
You know, we had hundreds of screw jacks. But there was, you know, there was pieces of it. Is hanging there, and so you know it was hard to know where to start to stabilize stuff.
Yeah, that was my question.
Everything was in terrible condition, and some things were. The Mascot Saloon was, you know, not too bad, but the Lynch and Kennedy, because it had been a barracks for the Buffalo soldiers, and so there wasn't a lot of underpinning. You know, they had moved that from some other part of town, cut it up, and the Lynch Kennedy and the building that's next to it, I can't remember, the one with the tower.
Not the Gold North Hotel?
No, that's across the street. I can't think of the name of it. But there was three structures, and they had literally severed these barracks buildings and then put a false front around them. And so structurally, they were terrible. And the people that owned the ones that are attached to the Lynch Kennedy did not like the Park Service, the Brennans. And I tried to get along with him, but I shot my mouth off one day, and his mom heard me, because I mentioned something about we're gonna fix this no matter what the Brennans think, and they heard me. So I got in a lot of trouble for that. But you know, that's just the way it was. You know,
they still owned it. The Lynch
and
Kennedy?
They did not own. We owned the Lynch Kennedy, but they owned their portion.
So was it an attached part?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a big attachment.
Okay.
Yeah, he never would. Bob was would tell Brenna that, you know, there was Buffalo soldiers in that thing at one time, and he says, no, there wasn't. He was being very racial about it. He didn't want to think that there had been, you know, Buffalo soldiers in his building at one time. But anyway, I believe Bob. I mean,
that's Bob Spooty.
Yeah, he did the research on it. He knew.
Right, and so was that part of the building restored as well?
The Brennans were working on theirs,
okay.
Doing stuff, and we were working on ours. And I think theirs was farther along, you know. But Lynch Kennedy was just like. I kind of put it in the category, we'll stabilize it and we'll move on. You
mm-hmm.
know, that's kind of what I did with everything except the railroad depot. That we focused on actually going into it. And that building on the south side in particular was ready to fall down. I mean, literally. The regional office had gone in there and put some bolts to hold it together and some strong backs. Because they put a wall of windows on the back of the admin building facing the Lynn Canal.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like the worst place they could have done that.
But who did that? The railroad?
The original builders.
Yeah, okay.
The original design was, it had a flat roof, and it emptied out over those windows. Okay?
Oh, great.
There was a gutter, but, you know, in a big storm, it was just terrible. So over the years, that entire wall, the south wall of the administration building, had rotted away. It was just barely hanging there. The only reason it was still up was because they had put the strong ties in. And
what are strong ties? Is it like a cable
it's
system?
It's like, well, it's bolts and then beams that run across, and then you sandwich the wall between the beams.
So you have a beam on the inside and a beam on the outside?
On the outside, and then bolts that go through it.
Okay.
And that kind of holds it together.
Okay.
But, I mean, they were rusting, and it was bad. You know.
So did you decide to focus on the depot because the park knew they wanted to use that as their admin offices?
Yeah, we needed a visitor center. We were above the grocery store at the time, that little grocery store on Broadway. Reeves or something? I can't
remember. Reeves,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, I thought I needed to have a goal, because I felt that the crew that was going to work on it needed to have that same goal. And as it turned out, it worked out pretty well, because I eventually had a crew that I could depend on. Buddy Honan was the lead carpenter. Bill Huns was the electrician. And then Cy Dennis, all those guys, you know.
Andy Byerly
was there. We had Gene Irvin for a while, but he was another story altogether. But
he ended up working on the Bishop's house.
Got him from the Bishop's
house. Oh, I see. Okay.
I told him I needed somebody there, like when I go travel, I needed somebody there to take the lead, but he was not the guy. He just was not well suited for that position. But anyway, I had him for a while. And
but his background was also historic architecture or
no,
construction?
I'm not sure. I think he had a literature degree or something. I don't think he had a technical background.
Okay.
I don't care, but, you know, it was...
That was just for people who don't know who he is, as I was just trying to provide some context of who he was and what he was doing for the Park Service.
Yeah, I think he worked in Sitka. He worked as a day laborer, you know, and he was just a local that they hired to help him.
Okay.
And then when I needed somebody, they sent me him. So, but anyway...
And what was Buddy's last name?
Honan, H-O-N-A-N.
Okay.
I've got some pictures with...
Well, we can look at those maybe
okay.
afterwards.
It has all their names on there.
Yeah.
I don't remember them real good.
But
anyway, I was evolving...
This was a good crew.
Yeah, I was evolving a crew, because we not only had to restore, you know, work on the structural aspects of the building, we had to rebuild all the windows and doors.
Mm-hmm.
There was just, you know, no way around it. And at the same time, I'm working with the people I knew at the Denver Service Center, the engineers. Like Pete Topka was the structural engineer. He and I were good friends for many years. And there was a mechanical and electrical engineer that I got. And I could call them up and consult with them,
mm-hmm.
which was very beneficial. Because at some point, I would send stuff down to Pete, and he would just design it and send it back, and then we would implement it. Because
mm-hmm.
just to give you an idea, structurally, the building was like a giant mushroom. It had a two-story masonry safe in the center, and it was actually on a stone foundation.
Wow.
It was one of the few things that I'd ever seen on a stone foundation. But the rest of the building was on a wood foundation. So it had collapsed
around that,
and that thing was sticking up, and you know, we had to lift, you know, we had to excavate under the entire building and then put lifting beams and, you know, literally dig a hole for a person to get into so they could put a screw jack in there, and we would do that throughout the underside of the building. And a lot of these people I had never dug anything in their life. You know, I got whoever I could get.
Mm-hmm.
And I had people doing things under there that they shouldn't have been doing. You know, you'd say, well, I haven't seen so-and-so for a while. Where are they? Well, they're still under the building. Well, are they digging or what are they doing? You know, so we had conveyors and, you know, we just kept at it until we dug it all out and jacked it all up.
What about archaeological clearance for under
well,
that?
Well, anytime we needed archaeological clearance, we got it. I worked with Kathy. She was Kathy Blee at the time.
Yeah.
But, we would, if we found something in the builder's trench, we would stop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we had clearance to do what we were doing at all times.
So, when you jacked up the building, did archaeologists go in ahead of you to look for things?
Well, not really.
Okay.
You know, I don't remember them doing that. I do remember that we wouldn't have been digging had they not cleared it.
Right, that's what I was wondering.
They probably didn't think there was anything that significant under there. But we did find stuff in the builder's trench when we started.
So what's the builder's trench?
That's the original excavation for the structure that when they built it.
Hmm.
And you find things in there like hats. We found one of those old tiny hats, you know, it looks like a race car driver hat, you know, on a flat. I forget what they call those kind of hats. It's got a little, real short bill.
Hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, we would find historic artifacts. We would just stop everything and, you know, do what we had to do. And Kathy was up there a lot. Sometimes
right.
She would be on another site and I'd just say, you know, you need to come over and look at this. You know, it was that kind of thing. She was doing archaeology under the Moore House when I was living in it.
Oh, my goodness. Had they raised it up or she?
Well, I think they dug under it. I can't remember, you know, to be honest with you, Karen. I think they may have. I know she was excavating. She may have excavated.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe because she was doing the cabin as well as the house. But yeah, she was. Yeah, we just had all this stuff going on kind of simultaneously because we really didn't have a choice. You know, I think we all wanted to save the resources, but you had to balance, you know, preserving the resource with making enough progress to where they would keep the funding coming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, eventually it got to the point where I couldn't spend the money I was getting because Senator Stevens,
mm-hmm.
he would, and even James Watt.
Well, former Secretary of the Interior.
Yeah, he had a big sign he gave to all the parks, restoration of the parks. And I thought, yeah, we're doing restoration. So we put his sign up out front and it says restoration. And we got a bunch of money for boardwalk from him.
And that's not what he meant by restoration?
I don't think so.
I don't know what he would have meant.
Well, I think he meant restoration in terms of not historic restoration, but say a park has not had maintenance funds for a period of time. I think that's what he was probably after.
Okay.
I don't know. But anyway, we...
I was sort of wondering what the pressures were of why you had to be in such a hurry.
Well, part of it was a manufactured hurry so that people wouldn't homestead. If I didn't set goals, people would literally sit there, you know, and I needed people that were goal-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And Buddy was like that. Mark Brooker, he was this hippie guy, big guy, nicest guy you'd ever meet, and he lived out in the woods. And he was just one of the best carpenters, sort of a naturally good carpenter, you know, you could say, need a new post that looks like that, and he'd come back and he'd get on the lathe and come back and he'd have it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was getting the people onto that crew that they liked it, they enjoyed what they were doing,
mm-hmm.
and I think that having that goal was essential.
Mm-hmm.
Had we not had it, you know, it wouldn't have worked. So we kept pushing, and none of us, you know. I had never built a door before. I had never built a window. I just didn't tell them that. And so I would watch them. I knew what a window should look like. I knew what a door should look like. And it was between my knowing where we needed to go and their skills getting up to where they needed to be, you know, because a lot of the fellows I got did not know how to use a hammer and a nail. They were used to using pneumatic nailers, and we were using hammers and nails.
And why?
Well, I think that was the industry standard. I wasn't getting people that were trained in historic restoration.
No, but for historic restoration, you have to do it by hand with the hammer.
Well, I think it's the preferred way.
Okay.
Yeah, it's you know, you don't always see it, but you know, I think, you know, if you're doing siding, it makes sense. If you're doing roofing, I don't know. You could. There's probably other architects that might say, yeah, you could use a staple if you're not going to see it. But I just felt we needed to be traditional about it.
Okay.
And I think it made them care more about what they were doing. If you get a fellow with a pneumatic nailer, they can kind of go a little crazy with them.
Yeah.
You know, I had one guy that, he was kind of a questionable guy, but he was doing shingles, and I found out he was signing them all. And then I found out he murdered somebody up in northern Alaska somewhere. So we had some guys that didn't last long.
Yeah.
But once we had a guy that, yeah, I had a Mormon fella, and I can't remember his name, but he was amazing. He was a teacher. We had a lot of teachers. Because of the seasonal thing, mm-hmm. You know. He came in and he took scrap wood and he built himself a boat and went fishing in the Lynn Canal with it. And he grew a garden. You know, the guy was always doing stuff. And I had another fellow that was a teacher and he got cancer and passed away right in the middle of all of our stuff. But, I just really enjoyed the guys and the enthusiasm that they had, because it really made the difference. Because we had to go the extra mile. We learned things the hard way. Like, we built a bunch of doors. They were beautiful doors. And we leaned them up against the wall. Came back in a couple of days to get them, and they were all bowed.
Oh.
They were destroyed. We had to destroy them.
How come that happened?
Well, two reasons. One, you should never do that. But two is that, you know, wood.
Meaning you should install them right away?
Yeah, well, you certainly don't want to lean them against the wall where they're in an unnatural position, you know. And the lumber we use, even though I bought the best lumber I could buy, it was not as good as the original lumber that things were built out of. You know, those original doors, they might have been able to build them like that, I don't know. But we learned that's the kind of lessons we learned, because once you see that, you don't do it again.
Right.
You know, and we learned some tools would work better than other tools. And
did you have to make tools?
No, we never had to. The only tool issue I had, that a lot of times I get guys arguing over, you know, you took my square, and that was my grandfather's square, and you didn't bring it back. You know, and I'd hear these arguments on site, so I told everybody to put their tools in their trucks, and then I went and bought a bunch of Navy CB chests full of tools, and I said, there's your tools. They're government tools. And then I never heard any more about it. You know, I had to learn. I grew up in a construction family, but I had never done construction. But I knew that when I was a kid, my dad would bring guys in and he'd have to be really tough with them. And you had to be tough with these guys, because it's a tough job. And what you do affects what somebody else does. And on down the line. So what I was doing was I was designing as they worked on the building. So I'd go up and I'd spend an hour or so doing design work, designing details for doors and windows and things. And then I'd go out and I'd implement the changes like almost immediately.
So you were both the architect / designer and like the general contractor supervising
go.
The right. guys doing the work.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, and plus I was the regional architect.
Yeah.
So, and that's why with my operation, when I had to leave to go out to other parks, it was not a good thing.
Right.
Yeah, and that's why we had Gene come in, but Gene was not capable of, because we had some guys do some stuff to a building and there was nobody watching them, you know. Just on a sidecar, or a side thought here, we had one fellow come up, his name was Herschel Fowler. He was an old wildcatter from Texas. I loved that guy. He really had some grit, you know. And we were removing, when the railroad depot, after a period of years, they had connected the front. Mm-hmm. There was like a connection, it wasn't a U. There was actually a hallway.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going to remove that. And we were having some trouble, and Herschel says, it's coming down. It's coming down. And he went out there, and he was standing in that thing, and it went down with him in it.
Oh, my.
He just wrote it down. It was sort of like Slim Pickens in that movie where he writes the atomic bomb down. But
so was Herschel in, was he a heavy equipment operator?
No, he was hired as a maintenance man for the park.
So how did he get it to come down?
Well, he probably was jumping up and down on it.
Okay.
And the guys were removing the underpinning connections. And, you know, it's just kind of a construction thing, and we were struggling with it. But it was just, he didn't get hurt or anything, but it was just sort of, and he had a heck of a time. You know, he moved up to Skagway. They brought his personal goods in on a truck, and they pushed them out the back of the truck, and his refrigerator and everything just dropped down.
Oh, my gosh.
Ruined a lot of his stuff.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't in the greatest mood to begin with. And, you know, it's like all of us when we went up there. You didn't have a place to live. If you didn't, you had to find a place, and it was tough.
And were people in town unpleasant?
Some.
Was there rudeness?
Some of them were. And sometimes it was, you know, like we ran out of fuel oil one time, and they didn't want the Park Service to have any fuel oil. So they just kind of, you know, and then the hardware store guy, Benny at the hardware.
Lingle.
Yeah, he was a character. He and I would go back and forth a lot. You know, I think he had a good heart, but he still had this sort of chip on his shoulder. I think that's how I would call it, you know, and I think the park poisoned the water by thinking they controlled everything in those early years. So a lot of people, they had chips on their shoulder, and you had to work with them to gain their respect.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I saw it, you know. And one of the things I would do is, you know, a lot of times the guys up there would not wear construction helmets.
Ooh.
You know, so I started wearing mine all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd walk up and down Broadway with that yellow construction helmet on and just defy them, you know. And I don't know, after a period, I would say by 2 years after I'd been working, I not only had a good crew, but I had gained respect of a lot of the people in town. Plus, I think buying my own house helped because I think they felt that the Park Service subsidized everybody. And
right.
So I think that helped quite a bit.
And so with Benny Lingle, because he owned the hardware store, did you have issues with you weren't buying things from him for your projects? Or?
Well, it would be things like, I bought a lot of stuff through him, you know. But it'd be like, I'd have my hot water heater go out, and I need to get one for my house.
Mm-hmm.
And the hardware store would just make it conveniently difficult to get, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't hold it against any of them. It's just, I kind of understand how they felt, and part of my purpose was to change that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hired as many locals as I could. There were some locals that were just, they kept the chip.
Right.
And I just couldn't have them. And they were good people, they were good carpenters, but I didn't need the negativity on the crew.
But I was wondering if you bought locally at the hardware store for the restoration projects.
Yeah.
You were able to do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes too much. I remember I had a whole train load of particle board we were going to put down. Found out it was incompatible with the glue for the finished surface that we were going to use, and we couldn't use it. And, of course, particle board, you don't ship back.
Right.
So we were giving particle board away for a long time.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah, because you couldn't sell it either.
You couldn't sell it. You know, it cost so much. It cost more to ship it than it was worth.
Right. Well, and also the Park Service can't go turn things around and resell them like
that. Right.
So
we just gave it away. now, but and we helped people where we could, you know, we gave them jacks and stuff to borrow.
Mm-hmm.
But so anyway, we kept pushing on that project until I wanted to have it. I had a date set, you know, in the 4 years. I wanted to have it done,
mm-hmm.
and we did finish it.
That was the depot building.
Yeah, both the admin and the depot. Yeah. You know. You know, it's not to say it wasn't without issues. I mean, I've been even recently in contact with Carl. Mm-hmm. They're still having trouble with that south wall.
Oh, really?
Because it's inherently a bad design. And I told him, you almost need a marine architect to give you some kind of guidance on how to seal those windows. We did everything we could.
Because that's so exposed to the weather,
yeah.
That side?
Even with a storm window on it, it's not enough. You know, the water gets pressed in there at such a pressure because the wind's blowing at 50, 60 miles an hour and it's wet and it just, and then you got the roof that's draining that direction.
Right.
It's all the worst things in the world. But,
Well, even with gutters, yeah. Okay, I don't know, maybe you can't put gutters up because they're not historically...
It historically had a gutter,
okay.
And we put it back. But any kind of storm can be bad enough to overwhelm it.
Right, right.
That, or after a period of time, the caulking starts to break down or one thing or the other. So it's a constant. It'll be always a difficult thing for the park to deal with.
Well, I mean, and you finished it in 1984... Right.
Right.
And now we're in 2019. That's a lot of years that...
Right. Well, I'm sure they've done a lot to it in the meantime. But they're still... Carl asked me, well, what can I do? Well, I told him, I said, I lost a lot of sleep over that 30 years ago. So, but anyway...
But that building... So the depot and the admin, it's sort of two buildings, but they're connected.
They're connected.
Over the hallway.
They're connected in the back.
Yeah.
Connected in the back. You know, one of the interesting things, we painted it the wrong color initially, the depot. And we didn't have really good paint information. We'd had somebody years ago, a professional, come in and give us some paint codes. But they, you know, and for the most part they worked. But the depot was an interesting building because I wasn't finding what I thought I should find when we were taking it apart. But I always noticed that in the gutters, there was something yellow in the gutters. And I passed it off to being, you know, a growth or something. You know, who knows? It'd been sitting up there for so long. And I finally, by really looking at the history of the building, the historic photographs, and how the chimneys were painted, the roof had been painted yellow. Then once I figured out the roof had been painted yellow, I realized that the trim... wasn't green, it should be yellow. So then the park changed it. And that happened after I moved to Anchorage, that changed. But and then one of the other cool things that happened on that building was the chimneys. I don't know where we found this guy. He was a mason, old-fashioned old guy. And him and one of my helpers got up there and built a chimney a day.
Whoa.
From scratch. And they looked perfect.
Out of...
And they're still standing.
And they built them out of masonry?
Well, we had bricks. We had to... The historic chimneys were gone.
Mm-hmm.
They had been gone for a long time. But I always tease Carl, and I don't know how serious he thinks I am, but mm-hmm. I told him, I said, you should paint the roof yellow. That's what it was. You know, and then Bob will come back and Bob Spooty, he'll say, well, they had, because it used to have real long eaves and no gutters, the depot. And Bob will come back and say, well, those pictures were made when it still had long eaves. And when those eaves were cut back, it wasn't yellow anymore. And I keep telling Bob there was yellow paint in the gutters. So, you know, this kind of back and forth kind of still goes on about things, but I feel pretty good about it. But I think if they painted the roof yellow, it would actually save them money in the long run. It's just people can't imagine painting a roof. But that's what they used to do.
Really? To help it last longer?
Yeah. Well, and I think it was a decorative thing.
Mm.
Because it had red chimneys, and they didn't paint the whole chimney yellow. They just, they did like the corbels and stuff. You know, it was probably pretty fancy looking at the time. Yeah.
But so the chimneys, you got rebuilt out of brick?
Yep. And we used modern brick and somehow figured out a way to size it to make it look like... Because see, brick changes all the time. You're not going to find, unless you pay a lot of money... You're gonna use contemporary materials a lot of times,
mm-hmm.
you know. So that was interesting. And then you know the administration building was all sheathed with cedar, matched cedar, mm-hmm. beautiful wood. The unfortunate thing is the roof had leaked for 30 years, and the wainscot was just destroyed.
Oh.
So we had to buy all new cedar. And we had to lay, because you can't buy matched cedar anymore. We had to lay it all out in the building, and then we matched it.
Wow.
So you'll go into some of those rooms, and you'll see one room might be a little darker than mm-hmm. another. But we tried our best to follow that. Because we found there was so much damage. You know, I talked to people that had worked in the administration building, you know, toward mm-hmm. the end of its life. And they had to work around the drips, because
wow.
the roof was just terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But and then they had safes up there, big heavy safe.
Upstairs?
Oh, yeah.
I know there's the one downstairs.
Oh, we had to take one out wow. because it was overstressing the floor.
I'm sure.
And we took it out with a forklift. Out. We actually took out part of the wall.
The back wall? The south wall?
No, it was the side wall, actually. Because we were doing windows, you know, and we had it kind of down to its essence.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember how we made the hole big enough, but we did. We got it out.
And what happened to that safe? Do you know?
Well, the park had it. You know, in fact, that came up in discussion just recently. And I was telling Carl that, you know, when I left, all the safes were there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I don't know what happens in a park when you're not there.
Right. If it's still part of the collection or not.
Yeah,
you left the big one downstairs.
Well, the big one, the one that's built there,
mm-hmm.
there was no moving that.
Right. There were
several safes in that building. There was one upstairs, and I think there may have been one even downstairs. I just don't remember for sure, but I know there was one upstairs because it was stressing the floor.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So the one downstairs, we pulled the safe doors, and I heard, there again, there wasn't a lot of pool of talent.
Mm-hmm.
And I hired an artist, and I said, can you do pinstriping? I said, we need to paint the safe door. And she did a fair job of it. I don't know if it's lasted or not, but she repainted that entire safe door. You had to sandblast the whole thing down and then repaint it. And whether that was the right thing to do, I don't know. It was. I think it had been leaked on for so many years that it was just in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
So we just started over again. But, you know, we made decisions that I think at the time, you know, if you look back, if you were making the same decision today, it might not be the same decision. But we made the problem I've always noticed in historic preservation, you have to make a decision at some point.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of preservationists get stuck and they can't make a decision. And then the resource eventually suffers because of it, you know. I had that happen with Castillo de San Marcos, the fort down there in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
They had been studying that thing for years and years, and meanwhile, it's just melting away. I finally got involved in that project, and I told them, it just needs a new terraplane, it needs a new roof. And that's what we did,
yeah.
Fixed the problem.
Well, that was one of my questions about the relates to the decision-making, is how you decide what you're restoring it back to.
Well, that's a good question, you know, because we were kind of behind the ball on doing the research on that building. It essentially made decisions right there.
Because you said you thought it was one way and Bob Spooty thought a different
book.
So how do you just decide we're restoring it to the way it looked now? Versus
well,
a different photo.
I think that in terms of the paint color, that was pretty much a, you know, nobody has painted the roof, so
mm-hmm.
that decision never
right. but you
was
know,
implemented.
You had a photo of it that maybe showed gutters, and maybe another photo didn't have gutters.
Right. The problem is we don't have one with the photograph that shows gutters with painted chimneys.
No.
So just because we don't have the photograph doesn't mean it wasn't so.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is I found evidence of paint in the gutters.
Right.
So that tells me they were painting that roof after it had gutters.
Right, because it dripped into the...
Right. For many paint jobs.
Right.
Because there was a lot of it in there. And that's and I didn't even, like I say, I didn't realize it was paint at the time. But it just sort of dawned on me that that's what...
But that is the question. How do you, you know, especially a building where you have so many photographs, and if the building has changed through time, what was your decision on that?
Well, I think that at the time we had made decisions on what we like taking out that connector. We knew that was a layer connector, and I think we were there was no real set thing that said we should restore it to some period. I think we were doing more. It was really only supposed to be adaptive use.
Okay. What is that?
Adaptive use means you go in and you keep the outside the way it is, historic appearing, and then you go inside and you do contemporary finishes.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that was appropriate, whether it was right or wrong, because everything was still intact inside.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt we needed to fix up what was in there. We did make some changes, like in the lobby. There was like a ticket booth there, and it made the lobby really unusable for what we wanted to do it with. So we removed the ticket wall, but then we built a counter that followed the same shape as that where that wall had been.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's still there. They may have changed that by now, but that was the intent, was mm-hmm. to at least recognize there had been a partition there. So we were trying to... I would say the answer to your question is we really were trying to keep it as much as what was there that made sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that connector that was hastily built between the two buildings in the front, just, it didn't make a lot of sense. And it created a kind of an area in there that was dead, you know, so.
Because now that's that open area, right?
Right, and that's the way it was historically.
Yeah.
I mean, we had the plan, you know, we knew.
Did you have a historic architectural plan for it?
I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, I know you had photographs.
Yeah, I'm not so sure we had a historic plan. I can't remember. See, we had a historic structure report at one time, and it got lost somewhere.
Mm.
Where we had, not so much the report, but the photographs. Because one of the historians from Washington, D.C. came out, and, Gordon Chappell. You mm-hmm. probably know him.
No, I've heard the name.
He used to call him Choo Choo Chappell. He really liked trains. So he came out and he did a heck of a job photographing that building, but somehow in the mix we lost all of his photographs, and I don't know where they ever ended up.
Hmm.
But he had some that he had taken other times. But I would say that with the railroad depot, it was primarily working with physical fabric and just seeing what was there and mm-hmm. kind of going with it.
So you didn't have we want to restore it to... you know, 1900 to 1910 or something.
That wasn't really part of the master plan. It was really adaptive use. It was, we were actually doing what, we were going probably to another level than mm-hmm. they probably would have wanted us to. But, you know,
in terms of keeping it as authentic inside as possible?
Yeah, you know, because it had some really neat, it had like railroad beams where you have the, you know, you look at the bottom of a railroad car and how that's sprung.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they had beams in there like that. And
wow.
I couldn't see taking that kind of stuff out of there.
As long as it's not a safety question.
Right. Well, and, you know, we did some adaptations. We put a theater in there. I had to put a big glue lam in there to do that because you can't have a good visitor center without a theater. So I think we were responsive to doing adaptive use, but doing it with a little more finesse than,
mm-hmm.
you know.
And you have to add disability access and restrooms.
Yes. Yeah, that came back to haunt me. We were 3/4 inch off in one of the bathrooms.
Uh-oh. For disability access?
What happens is we did old-timey dividers between the toilets, mm-hmm. and we put too much trim on them, probably. Anyway, they had to come back in and fix it because somebody probably had a hard time getting into the bathroom. So, lesson learned there.
Right. But and then what about an elevator? That had to be put in that building?
Well, you know, I probably if we were doing it today, yeah, we didn't. But I would say that, you know, if you have all the functions on the one level, but since you got most of your offices upstairs there,
yeah,
you would probably have to. If we were doing it again, you'd probably.
But you didn't have to.
Let's put it this way: I didn't get in trouble for not doing it.
Yeah, I can't remember if they've had to put one in, or if they use one of those, you know, stair.
I would say put a stair lift in would be the easiest thing.
That might be what's there. I can't remember.
Yeah, we didn't do it, you know, at that time because it just wasn't. You know, accessibility wasn't as big as it should have been, but.
Mm-hmm. The thing I was wondering about with the depot and the admin being one or two buildings, when you worked on restoring it and jacking it up, did you jack the whole thing up?
Well,
you didn't do one part and then the other part?
We did the whole thing.
Wow.
And we did kind of, like I was working with Pete Tonk, and we actually designed it with slots. Because we had to get it up and then pour the concrete and then set it back down. And like I was saying, the you know, it kind of had the mushroom effect. Mm-hmm. And what happens with those old first growth floor joists, once they get a set, you got to cut them. You know, the bow is furrier. I lifted that building once. I was going to try and because the floor was bowed.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, we'll just lift it up and straighten those floor joists out. Well, the whole building lifted out of the ground and the bow stayed in it.
Oh.
That's how strong that wood is.
Yeah.
And it was the same thing at the railroad depot. What we had to do is we had to cut the floor joists at convenient points where we could put a pier because we couldn't straighten them. So we did a lot of that.
So you put in new straight pieces to fill in?
Well, we used the original, if we could, we used the original timbers. A lot of it was dry rotted and we had to replace it, but it was a combination.
Mm-hmm.
But we had to get everything up so that we could get in there and pour the concrete. We moved a lot of dirt out from under that
thing. You must
have. You know, it just, and we lifted it like well over a foot.
Wow.
But it was like you would pour the concrete in and then you'd kind of stuff it and then put a form up against it. It was really tight. So, and we did such a good job. We did a lot of earthquake resistance design in that building. And we did a really good job because once I started, you know, actually having my office in that building,
mm-hmm.
My lamps would sit there and go like this.
Did shake?
Yeah, and what it is they had submarine generators that made the town's power over there by the Poland House.
Mm.
And it literally would, the vibration from the earth would come up into the building and then be distributed because it was designed like that, mm-hmm. you know, to resist earthquakes. But I never thought about there being a vibration in town that would be coming in. So we'd all sit there in the lamps. They probably still do.
I don't know. Yeah, they would shake.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the floor. So when you lifted the whole thing up and you put a new foundation and you had to put new joists in that were straight or pieces of joists.
Well, we sometimes sistered joists. If we could keep a historic joist, we did.
Mm-hmm.
But as you got toward the outside of the building, the drywall was pretty bad, so it was a combination of.
But then, with the actual floor of the building, did you take that out?
Most of it. Sometimes we did. Sometimes we didn't. There again, it depended on how much damage there was, and that if it still had integrity, we would leave it.
Mm-hmm.
If it didn't, we would replace it. So, if you were to peel that building back, you would find kind of a mix mash of things, you know, a lot of plywood and mm-hmm. not plywood. And
because the floor that you walk on is a cover.
Well, it had a tongue and groove floor, a finished floor.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't, you know, there again, we were doing adaptive use. And the actual finish for most of the floors was Battleship Linoleum.
From the old building? The original building?
Yeah, the
building?
Historic building. Battleship Linoleum lasts forever.
And it's ugly.
Well, maybe ugly, but it's historic. And so we found some rubber that looked like Battleship, and that's what we put in. I think they've since changed to something else, but that's where I had the incompatibility with glue.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, the Battleship Linoleum was, that's you know, that was, you know, it's adaptive use, but there again, we're trying to keep the flavor. You know, as we would find wallpapers and stuff, I had Judy Ronskavage, the DSC interior designer in those days. She helped me find some wallpaper that didn't match it, but that was compatible with it.
Mm-hmm.
So if it was a green pattern wallpaper, we found a contemporary green pattern wallpaper that was similar.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a lot of that. You know, we're true to the spirit of how the building looked. And I think it turned out looking like that. You know, I think it has that sort of sense of a old-time railroad depot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and so you got it done in your four-year period?
I did. For $1.5 million. I was always real proud of that. It was within budget because we did everything ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, you say, you know, the guys who worked on it... learned a lot along the way.
Oh, well, by the time we were done, they were preservation. Mm-hmm. You know, they had skills that they probably never dreamed they would have. And because we were turning out doors and windows. Boom. One of the things that happened early on, we had somebody come in. We were trying to stabilize it. And so this guy came and he said, I'll glaze your windows for you. He went in there and he glazed our windows and he used silicone. And I was ignorant at the time, but silicone is not what you glaze wood windows with. And it ruined a lot of our historic windows the depot. And that, because what would happen is in order to get the silicone out, you'd have to channel the wood. And by the time you channel it, then the wood is too thin, you know, to be a window. So that's one of the reasons we had to replace all the windows. A lot of it was because of that guy in that silicone that just, and I, all through my career, I battled silicone. It's the worst thing that can ever be put on anything. There's no way to remove it. It chemically bonds to whatever you put it on. You know, people use it on fish tanks. Even when you put it on glass, you can't get it off. You can get the most of it off, but a remnant stays on there.
And what's the purpose of using silicone, like on the windows?
To seal it. You know, what he should have used was window glazing. And I had assumed that's what he was going to do because I thought he was a glazier.
Mm-hmm.
Well, apparently, you know, sometimes you get people that sell themselves as something and they're not. And what he did was not good.
So you had to remake all those windows?
Yeah, all of them. There's like over 100.
Yeah. I think it's amazing, though, that, you know, you look at a historic photo, and so you know what the window or the door looked like, and then those guys pretty much copied it.
Yeah, well, we had enough historic fabric there. We knew what the shapes were. We would just use... We'd use it as a pattern. Mm-hmm. And it worked great until we got to hardware. We couldn't, and back in the 80s, there wasn't a lot of people that did historic hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So we got somebody to do our hardware. We gave them the patterns. We gave them samples. And they did the brass hardware, but they did cast brass. And it's not the same as the kind of brass doorknobs and stuff that it had. It was more like a... I don't know what you would like tin.
Like a shell.
Like a shell, right. What they would end up giving me is a solid brass doorknob because there was nobody out there that knew how to make these things anymore.
Right.
Now, there's probably people out there doing it today, but not in the 80s.
But so you had examples of the original doorknobs?
Yeah, we kept I put everything on a board. I took a sample of everything, and I don't know if the park lost that because I never really heard whether they... had it.
Mm-hmm.
I had samples of all the wood shapes, the you know, with paint on them and everything, and all the hardware. I nailed it to a board, and I said, "You need to put this in the collection." I think there was some debate on whether that deserved to be in the collection. I worried it fell between the cracks, but we did it.
Yeah. So you didn't use the original doorknobs. You couldn't put those back
on?
We
did if we could, but there again, most of them were like damaged or unusable. You know, if we could use them, we would. But I think that the hinges we had built, and we paid a lot of money to have them built, but they didn't, you know, they cast them and they don't wear well. You know, hardware has to be built tempered. If I were doing that job today, I'd be much more particular about the kind of hardware we put on it. I mean, they look, what we did looked good. It just didn't work good.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it's finding the, how do you find those kind of specialized artisans who might know
well,
how to do
today
that?
You go on the internet. Back in the 80s, you just call around, you know, and you see what kind of local tool, talent you have. You know, like doing the sign on the mascot. We had a local artist do that. I think she was the same lady that did the door.
The safe?
Yeah, on the safe. Just local talent.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had talked about the paint, and that's something that I find fascinating, how you could figure out the colors. And
well, we had had...
since all the photos are black and white.
Well... You look at the black and white photograph, but you also look at your evidence, you know, like
your physical evidence.
Your physical evidence, and then you kind of develop a chronology, you know. And is it 100% accurate? You know, in the 80s, probably not. Nowadays, I think things are a lot more sophisticated, but, you know, we used to crater stuff with a knife just to see the layers.
Can you dig out a little area?
Yeah, you just keep cratering it, and then you can see the layers. The problem with the railroad depot, it was in such a state of deterioration. The only place you could really find good paint was under the eaves and stuff. But I don't know where we got the green paint idea on the depot. I think there was an assumption made if one green was over there, there'd be green over there. I think it was just a bad assumption.
Mm-hmm.
But... you know, if I see something I've done that maybe could be improved, I go back and I just fix it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we did a lot of that. We had to. Trial and error.
Yeah. Well, it does sound like a lot of research. You say old photos,
yep,
historic documents, and you did all that research? Or did you
well, I think Bob did all the historic, you know. When I do research, I'm going to Bob's files, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he's done all the historical research, and he was very thorough, and there was a lot there, and it was a well photographed town.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to work with this town; they didn't, hardly anybody took pictures of anything.
It's eerie here.
Yeah.
I know the Gold Rush time period for Skagway is amazingly well photographed.
I mean, I had a photographer's studio in my backyard of my house.
In Skagway?
Yeah, I had three historic buildings back there. Well, I was just talking to Carl. He kept looking for this one called The Pick. We finally realized it was one of the buildings that was behind my house.
Hmm.
And there were, you know, I think it was a crib, and I think the other one I had there was a crib. And so I think there was two cribs and a photography studio. So there was all these commercial buildings. That's why I say 6th Avenue was probably the deal.
Hmm.
I need to get something to drink.
Sure.
Of coming to a solution on it. It was sort of like fast track with the railroad depot, because we just didn't have the time to wait for a lot of the things that we, you know, if we were doing it today, we probably would be more prudent about it. But it was like that. Park had languished for a number of years. Nothing was being done.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that even before I moved up there. And I thought, you know, I think I can make a difference up here.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned those old buildings behind your house, and it leads me to the question about how much buildings were moved in Skagway throughout its history.
You just have no idea.
And how that affects your historic preservation work.
Well, it becomes part of the historic story, you mm-hmm. know. Moving buildings was just, you know, like the Golden North, they moved that thing all over the place.
It's amazing.
You know, and Pack Train Saloon. That's Brenna's building.
Okay.
It just dawned on me. They moved that. They cut it in half. They moved it. You know, there was a lot, like any town. There was probably a history when the Buffalo Soldiers were there. Who knows what went on? But
well, I was wondering, is moving of buildings typical for historic towns? Or was something special about Skagway that they did it more?
Well, I think Skagway had the advantage of things freezing. They would move things after it got really cold, you know. And when the tide came in, if that water would freeze or not. But it might have made it like a big ice skating rink. Hmm. It might have been more opportunity. But I think it's like this. You're up there back in the day of sailing ships, and you need to do something. Mm-hmm. Are you going to order it from Seattle and have wood shipped up and build it? Or are you just going to get a bunch of guys and some horses and just move it where you want it? I think that's kind of what, because it's so isolated, you know, I think the isolation was the big deal, because of course they had the train at some point, but still the town itself, doing stuff within the town, I think just made sense. If you liked your building and you want to move it over here, then just do it.
Yeah.
You know. So
but they must have used horses.
I think they used anything.
And skids.
They may have used tractors. You know, they had.
Did they have tractors?
Well, I think they had at some point. They did.
Well, not in the gold rush, they wouldn't.
Well, but you know, Skagway 19. You know, the gold rush was like kind of early.
Yeah.
And a lot of those buildings that we see on Broadway, they're like 1910, you know, they're a few years after.
You mentioned, you know, the guys crawling under the depot admin building, and all I could think of was, what would OSHA health and safety requirements have been?
Well,
were there any?
There might have been. You know, I had never run a construction crew. I had never done it. It was, we tried to be as professional as we could. We wore helmets, you know. We wore masks when they went under. But, you know, it sort of depends on the individual. If they didn't want to wear a mask or a helmet, they wouldn't do it. And if they were under the building, you didn't see them. But, yeah, that was a... And we did it over and over again. Not only the railroad, we dug out under that. We dug out Lynch Kennedy, or continued... It would have been dug out before I got there, but we continued digging them out because we wanted to get them up off the ground.
Right.
And we got pretty good at it.
Did you have any accidents?
We had best I can recall, we had one minor accident. I think the guy might have fractured an arm or something. He fell off a ladder, but he was the fellow that was sick.
Okay.
And he had cancer, and I didn't know it. So I think he just had a weak moment.
Yeah.
But other than that, we never had any.
I'm surprised at jacking up the buildings that something didn't fall down on somebody at some point.
Well, we were extra careful.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what we would do is we would just have sessions where we'd get all the jacks set and then we'd do it all at once. And everybody, there would be like a person at each jack, and we'd give them a number of turns to do.
Mm-hmm.
And we just kept doing that until it came up. I got a picture of myself in a magazine standing out there with a measuring stick while they lift the thing up. I can't remember who that person was, that some kind of strange magazine.
So you could jack it up just high enough for somebody to crawl in?
Well, that was the problem, was getting it initial access. You had to just dig down. Like I was saying, they would dig a hole for them to be in. Because you couldn't really dig out the whole thing. You couldn't get access.
Right, and you couldn't lift it high enough.
Right.
You could only
lift it so much farther than where the safe was.
Right.
So... And that's what complicated pouring the foundation. I could not lift it high enough to really put the concrete in easily.
Mm-hmm.
So we lifted it up just enough to where we could get concrete and then pack it in.
Yeah.
You know, because it was, I knew if we severed that safe, we would be in dire straits.
Yeah.
And it was in pretty good condition. And it was brick.
Wow.
You know,
it was on a brick foundation,
It was on a stone foundation, but it was masonry. You know, it was a fireproof safe.
Oh.
They expected to put their gold in there. So they didn't mince any money on that.
But, yeah. And so you were now no longer working for the Denver Service Center.
Right, I was working for the regional.
But what was there a continued relationship with them and the projects in Skagway?
Yeah, we, I don't know, sure how they, sometimes they just gave me their design work for, you know, like on the back of a napkin, essentially. But they were still involved, you know, like when we were doing, I did not do structural design. I didn't do any of the engineering. I brought in the correct engineer for whatever discipline we needed. And we would, you know, we would have a line item contract or whatever we did to get the design work.
So the project paid for it for service center employee to do the work. Okay. Right. Do you remember who any of those engineers were?
Well, there was Pete Tomka. God. He was the structural, and I worked with him the most.
Right.
Man, I can't remember the other engineers because it just...
And then, as you said, Kathy Blee at the time, she was Denver Service Center doing the archaeology, and you mentioned the woman with the interior design.
Yeah, Judy Ronskavage. I went to every expert because I had a lot of acquaintances down in Denver, and I used my connections. They started to fade after a few years, but, you know, I used them while I had them, and it really, that's one of the things that saved us a lot of money on the project.
But, and then you worked on the Mascot Saloon as well?
I did the historic structure report.
Okay.
And when we did the stabilization of it, you know, we did roof, we replaced some siding, and, you know, we weatherized it, essentially.
So what does a historic structure report entail?
Well, it's really a pretty academic exercise. You go out, you measure the building, you do up a set of drawings that shows how the building exists, and then you do another set of drawings that shows how you're going to treat it. Okay, and then you write a narrative. You describe it, its existing conditions. I'll show you one when we're done.
Well, I've seen them. For somebody listening to this, it's sort of a description.
Yeah, well, it's a very in-depth analysis of the building, physical analysis.
And is there also discussion of what its known uses may have been in time?
Yes.
That a historian...
Yeah, the chronology. And, well, usually a historian works on them.
Mm-hmm.
You have a architectural section, and then you have a historic section. You might even have an archaeological section, depending on what you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
But usually it's like, I worked with historians a lot, and we would go back and forth. But my job was mainly, you go on site, and you would document the building, and then work with people.
Yeah, because the Mascot one, I think Bob Spoody was the historian.
Yeah, I think he probably might have been. Yeah. I've still got that somewhere around here.
Yeah, I've looked at it recently, a little background.
Yeah, because you'll go in there and it'll show the treatments. It's not a working drawing. It's not like a construction document. But it goes in and it gives you a general idea. Like we were talking about what needs to be restored and doesn't on the railroad depot.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially what I was doing on the railroad depot was writing, doing the historic structure report in a physical sense. I just didn't have the time to do a document.
Right. You just did it along the way.
Along the way, you know. And like I say, parts of it we had and we kind of lost. That's the disadvantage to doing stuff like that, because if you don't, hang on to stuff, that's not a good thing.
Well, that's what I was wondering, is all those drawings and things you were doing of the design along the way, what has happened to that material?
Park still has them.
They do have it, okay.
Yeah. I still have them. You know, so they're still, I don't have the originals. I think the park has the originals right. or the regional office. But I was always very careful to make sure that any kind of work I did was documented.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like that board full of samples. I always worried about that and it got getting lost, you know.
Right. Well, it sounds like a good technique to have that sample thing as a reference.
You needed it, you know. Yeah. And because then you can go back and recheck stuff as the technology gets better.
Mm-hmm.
So, but if you don't have it, you don't have it. And the trouble with the railroad depot is a lot of the stuff, you know, a lot of the paint got removed. Because one of the problems with the paint was, especially under the eaves where a lot of the historic paint was, it was so thick that you couldn't put a coat of paint on top of it without it blistering.
Mm.
So when it gets that thick, you have to remove it down to the substrate. And once you've done that, you've lost the historic record. That's why I put the samples on the
unless board. Unless you save those paint right. chips that you took off.
Right.
Yeah. And when you were working on the depot building, was the Skagway Historic District Commission a functioning body?
Oh, yeah. I was on it.
Okay.
Yeah, I worked with the town a lot. That's how I got in trouble with the West Doers. I wouldn't say in trouble with them, but I guess I tweaked somebody because they had to spend a lot of money to paint all those buildings.
Mm-hmm.
But you go back and look today, you know, that place, all the paint made a big difference. You know, it's really a colorful place. Because I use Google Streetscape and I go down and look at how things look. It's kind of mm-hmm. interesting because you can't even compare how it looks today with how it looked when I went there in '80. It's really not been that long.
No. Now, do you feel you played a role in that change?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think so. Well, you know, we were all, I think the regional office was new, and everything was new, so we were all learning in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think, you know, it turned out well at the time, and it seems to, you know, I've looked at pictures of it, they're doing a good job of keeping it up.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they won't paint the roof yellow.
So with the Historic District Commission, can you talk about your work with them? Or?
Well, I worked with the town, and we worked... let me give you a typical example. Somebody comes in on the cruise ship, and I'm sitting up there in the office, and I'm watching this lady go down the street, and she's dragging driftwood to one of the empty lots that the Park Service owns. And she's kind of laying this stuff out. She's thinking that she's building a shop. So there would be people that would just kind of blow into town and think they could kind of homestead, you know. And we would have things like that where these people would come to the commission and say, well, I want to do such and such. Well, you don't own the land. Well, the government owns it. I can do it. You know, that kind of stuff. And we had a lot of interesting sort of asymmetrical things people wanted to do. You know, everybody wanted to make money quick because
mm-hmm.
they were making money there. I mean, the waves of people come in, but it takes real talent to keep a shop up and all that. You just don't do it overnight.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a period when, you know, like they dragged these small buildings down there. And that's where, you know, I think it probably became a challenge for the park was how to deal with those empty lots. I think they were kind of kicking themselves for getting empty lots. And Bob and I kind of probably disagree on this, but I was not that much in favor of us buying a vacant lot and then dragging a historic building onto it. I don't know, I didn't sit well with me. But
why not?
Well, I just didn't think that it was historically accurate.
But if the town had historically been moving buildings...
They historically moved them. When you're doing it contemporaneously like that, that's mm-hmm. a different thing in my mind. You know, because you're in a period of history, and whatever you do in that period of history, that's history. But up here, this is here and now, and you're trying to do what they did back then. I don't know.
Would there have been the chance that there was evidence that the building had been in that lot originally.
Well, now that's a different that's a different thing, I would say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever had that situation.
Okay. Well, I know like the Jeff Smith Parlor building, which is a newer project.
Yeah, right.
Didn't they move that? Or George Rapuzzi moved it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely was moved.
But it was moved before the park got it.
Right. Okay. And I noticed they kept it right there.
Yeah.
And that's what I would have done.
Okay.
So, to me, these vacant lots we had were sort of like, I would just as soon see a contemporary compatible building go there than dragging a historic building there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's why Carl is kind of struggling with this pick building that's out there. It's a really neat little crib. And we were both looking at this historic photograph. And this was just like a couple weeks ago. And he says, well, I think that's your house. And I thought, well, I mean, and so I went back and I checked. And I looked at I have photographs of the house when I lived in it. And I was able to compare the siding and stuff on it. And it was my house. And I remember even where it was, because there was an area behind the house that was full of sand, and I think I put sand in there for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where that building was, because once you move a building, it takes a long time for vegetation to reestablish. And so that had been moved when probably Hamilton had it. He also took the photographic studio and moved it.
So that Pick building and that photo studio were not in the yard behind you, house, when you lived there?
Right. The photographic studio was there. I'm sorry. The photographic studio was there because I traded Hamilton that for the parlor stove that was in the Galt house, because he had that. This guy liked to go around and take stuff from buildings.
It's like Rapuzzi did the same
thing. Yeah, you know, that's why the first thing when I moved in, they had the newel post for the admin building in there, and I traded that and had the guy spin me up a real simple one for the house as a trade.
Right.
And so, yeah, I wished I would have never traded, because that was a neat building. But my goal was never to stay in Skagway anyway.
But so that Pick building,
that was moved before.
But now is it someplace else?
Yeah, it's on Broadway. At least I think it is.
So there's a building on Broadway that Carl's trying to figure out.
It's where it was moved from.
Its origins,
yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's still there, if it's been moved again or not, you know. And it's like, I don't know. I know Hamilton took that photography studio that was behind Kermsey's for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where it ended up. It was really a neat building. It was a kit. And before I traded it to him, he had cleaned out all the negatives. It had all the equipment in it. The plates, the glass plates, all that. He took it all out.
It wasn't Deadman's studio, was it?
No.
No.
No, this was Kermsey's.
Oh, okay.
That he owned. But the photography studio was just it was not a very big building. It was like, it couldn't have been more than maybe 15 feet long and maybe 8 feet wide. It was really small, just big enough to have a little studio.
Do you know the time period on that?
Well, I'm sure it was there at the Gold Rush. You know, there again, my theory is that 6th was the main drag early on. And I mean, the kids dug up some jewelry there. I'll show you. I got a piece of it. And, you know, we could have done historic archaeology there. Probably
every lot in that part of Skagway has some historic archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
And so you weren't involved with the mascot restoration or the archaeology, or
just the stabilization. You know, I think, well, Kathy had been doing, you know, she was all over the place. She was doing archaeology because she was clearing before I'd work on it, or either her crew or somebody, you know. And that's why we were doing something at the Moore house. I can't remember. We probably the sewer.
Mm.
We were probably trying to fix the sewer or something. Right. I don't know, but she was probably digging it to clear it. But it was a lot going on.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like the way a project would work, it's a lot of collaboration with the historic architect, the archaeologist, the historian, the construction crew. It's a big mishmash.
Yeah, it is. And it was sort of like, if I saw something that was out of my expertise, I started looking for somebody that could do it. You know, it's like interior finishes. I'd much rather have an interior designer do that than me.
Mm-hmm.
And And structural engineering, you always want to have good engineering, you know, for any of that stuff, you know. I did have an electrician. Bill Huns was my electrician, mm-hmm. and he was a local guy. It was kind of funny. He would his former wife was what was her name? Last name was Sear. I can't remember her first name. Alice Sear.
Oh, yeah.
She was a ranger, a part-time ranger.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd be in there giving tours. And I didn't know the two had been married. But every time she'd go to do a show, the fire alarm would go off because he would set it. But he was, you know, he was one of the locals I had then. He did all of our electrical work.
Great. Did you work on other of the buildings in Skagway?
Well, not to that. You know, I worked on all of them in the sense of trying to stabilize them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the ones that, you know, like the Itchin House was sitting out there, and we just put a roof on it. We roofed them and painted them and then covered the windows, mm-hmm. ventilated them. And if they were really down in the mud, we tried to get them up out of the mud. That's how I viewed all the other, with the depot, which took most of my time.
Right.
But, you know, it would be like if we had guys that didn't have anything to do on the depot, we'd put them over for stabilization work on other buildings.
So how big was your crew?
I would say there was about 16 guys at some points, sometimes bigger, sometimes smaller.
And that would have been in the summertime.
Yeah, you know, in the wintertime, it was more... I was trying to, you know, just think the other day how we did it in winter. I know we worked in the winter, but I can't remember how I worked the hiring, you mm-hmm. know, because it was, I think we did extensions, you know, and then we depended, you know, there's different kinds of positions. If you came in as a temp, summer temp, it was one thing. If you were hired by the park on the maintenance staff, it was another. So
mm-hmm.
I think some of the people that I had more long-term, like Andy and guys like that were on, Cy Dennis.
Right.
They became part of the permanent staff. Yeah. But,
and so what kind of work did you do in the winter? Was it all indoor work?
Yeah, we'd put plastic up and put a stinger in there. And
it's a stinger, one of those heater things?
Yeah, one of those horizontal gas heaters. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing we didn't burn anything
yeah.
down. But it was like, if you didn't do that, it would never be done.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there was... Before I got there, that's literally how they'd work like 3 or 4 months a year. I did the math, and it wasn't good.
Right.
I'd be there forever, and I did not want to be in Skagway forever. It was a neat town, a neat, great place to be, but, you know, I wanted to do other architecture besides that. And probably, besides, my wife would have killed me if I had stayed there.
She did not like living there?
No, she was not happy there. Alaska is not everybody's place. And then, mm-hmm. and when you can't get along with them, when the people were kind of mean to you, that makes it worse.
So because she was a wife of a park service
Oh, yeah.
They were not so friendly.
Well, an example was, you know, they would bring, the ship would come in with the supplies, with groceries at a certain time. They would never tell us what day it was, you know. Mm-hmm. So we'd go to the store and there'd be no food, you know. Just subtle little things mm-hmm. like that. It wasn't like real overt. It was subtle.
Mm-hmm. And were your kids in school yet?
Yeah, that was a problem too. Because well, my daughter, she was just a baby. But mm-hmm. my son, he was like in first grade. And I had a teacher call us up and tell us that my son's teacher was picking on him because he's a park service kid. You know, that just fries you right
yeah.
there. But that was some of the kind of the subtle things, that the oil, the food, all of that's kind of in the background, you know. And my way of confronting that was to just press that much harder on my goal to get things rolling. And I'm sure I wasn't real popular in the early days when I did things like painting buildings and you know, probably when I wore my construction hat, they probably thought I was being arrogant, but I was really just trying to tell them, we're going to do this no matter what,
mm-hmm.
you know. You know, and And the construction guys, you know, the guys that were the stevedores and the rebel, you know, there was kind of a hierarchy, and they felt that the people, the guys that worked for Park Service, were a little lower standard because they weren't union, you know, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that they had gone over to the other side,
yeah,
in a way, right?
Yeah, and there was some of that. And so that's why I wore the hat. And it was just making a statement, you know. I had another hat I wore for Dick, and it said, Howard Roark, what did it say? Howard Roark lives. You ever read The Fountainhead?
No.
Well, it's about an architect, basically, that if he didn't get his way, he would do ugly things. And I was just, me and Dick went back and forth a lot, so I had my other hat that I would wear for him, but I think, like I told him, I says, you know, you may not agree with everything I'm doing, but you're going to have one of the best offices in Alaska. I said, that's the goal here. It, you know, and if I really didn't want to argue with him about stuff, but he would get on things like I'd have some of the crew, well, we were stealing Rangers for one thing. He didn't like that because the Rangers would find out that they can make more money on wage grade. And so next thing I know, I have a lot of ex-Rangers on my crew. He didn't like that. So, but that was...
What were some of the other things that you disagreed about? Give some examples.
We disagreed about just about everything. I don't know. You know, I think...
Well, was he trying to give you direction on how you did the restoration?
He wanted to, he would come into the shop, for example, and if he didn't like what he was seeing, he would throw it on the floor. You know, like a guy might be working on a window or something and there's sawdust. Well, he'd come in and he'd think it's too dirty. And so he'd take the work and toss it on the floor.
Wow.
You know, there was just this rift between us. And I got along with Chief Ranger, Jay Cable, was a great guy. I got along with everybody, but there was this hang-up with Dick and his wife. You know,
was he that way to other of the staff that you witnessed, or do you think it was just something with you?
He was pretty mean to the seasonal employees. You know, he had a very structured thing about, you know, like he wanted room numbers on their rooms, so that they went in and they changed the room numbers. Oh, he just had a fit. You know, it's kind of like Captain Quigg in the... But
Moby Dick.
Yeah, well, the Kane Mutiny is what I'm thinking of. That's what he reminded me of, was Captain Quigg.
Well, that's why I was wondering if it was his general style of, he seemed to want to have a lot of control.
He did. He wanted to have ultimate control, and he wanted me in a uniform, and he wanted to control what I did. He wanted to set my priorities, you know, and he wanted me to be a park employee. And I just, it wasn't anything against the park, but I just knew if I went down that path, I would never finish. I would not accomplish what I did.
Well, and I find it interesting that somebody who's superintendent thinks they know more about how to restore an old building and do the work than someone who's a trained architect.
Well, I was young, he was old, you know. And I'll be honest with you, the superintendents they sent to Skagway had all come there with issues in the old days. They put them up there, you know, they might have had a sobriety issue, or I don't think Dick had that problem, but he had had problems at the park he came from. So I think that...
And they were near their retirement, and they were using out their last years.
I think it was sort of like, let's put them up there, you know, get them out of the mainstream. So I don't know. It just made our life, you know, the same way in Sitka. They had the same problem. Because I knew the guys that worked there real well. In fact, I would go down and oversee that project just from a regional point of
view. That was the Russian Bishops.
Right. And they had management down there that was fighting them all the time. And so
Yeah, so where else did you do historic architecture work in Alaska? You said because you were regional, you got sent to other places.
Well, you know, I went to a lot of places. I never really did much, but I would go places and look at lots of cabins. I went with the Forest Service in a helicopter down to Aniakchak, way down there where we have parks you can't even get into.
Right.
Flew into calderas and stuff and saw grizzly bears everywhere and found out that that's where they scratch themselves is on these historic cabins if there's anything sticking up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I went to, let's see, that was after I left Skagway. When I was in Skagway, I didn't spend a lot of time, but there was, you know, I did go places.
Mm-hmm.
That was back, I can remember, we had Diners Club card and they wouldn't pay for our travel. What a mess that was. I got in Sitka and I had no money. I had to talk a cabbie into taking me to the airport. I had nothing left.
Wow.
Because they wouldn't pay their bills.
The Park Service wouldn't.
Yeah. And then I used my personal credit card, but I was at GS7 or 9. And my credit card was maxed out. I had no money.
Wow.
You know, and those are kind of external pressures that went on around those days.
Mm-hmm.
And didn't make it any easier, but.
So, why did you decide to leave Skagway?
Well, I think it was always my plan. You know, I saw it as from the day I got there as kind of a 4-year deal,
mm-hmm.
and I tried to keep myself on that schedule, because, like I say, if you don't set a goal and try to achieve it, you're probably not going to do that. Mm-hmm. And it worked throughout my career. I kind of always was able to do that. I had a lot of challenges in Skagway because things were unexpected. And plus, I was still learning. You know, I was learning a lot. I was learning as much as anybody was.
And so you went to Anchorage from Skagway?
I went to Anchorage for about another 4 years.
And that's when you were the regional historical, what was it, regional historical architect?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, then they made the mistake of sending me to Dominica in the West Indies. And when I went there, I thought, I cannot live in the cold north anymore. And that was kind of the end of my Anchorage deal. Then I went to Santa Fe, and that didn't work real well either. But
and then you ended up back here in Denver?
Back at Denver Service Center. I just wanted to do architecture. That was my goal, you know. But I would say overall in my career, I was quite satisfied. It was really a fun time.
And when did you retire?
Let's see, 2008.
Okay.
My wife had early onset Alzheimer's.
Okay.
And I had to take care of her. But I still had my time in, you know.
Right, well, that's a long career.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good.
Well, you had talked about all the challenges in Skagway that you faced. What's something that was positive that you're most proud of?
Well, I think the challenges in themselves were positive, I guess. But I was proud of the fact that we finished on time. And I can still remember playing Gordon Lightfoot in the theater and those locals crying.
Really?
That was my best day. They were so happy to see that building restored. Still gives me goosebumps.
Cool. Well, and again, given some of the animosity, you finally get that validation from the community. It must have felt good.
I think by the time I was done, you know, I think the very fact that we accomplished something impressed people.
Yeah.
And I felt that I had their backing. Sometimes I felt I had more of their backing than I did the park, you know. But, you know, like I say, at the end, Dick got the best office. The town got their railroad depot restored, which I think they all really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
I, regardless of who they were, that building meant a lot. Most of them worked there.
Well, it's a very, very significant building in the history of that community.
Oh, yeah.
And it would be sad to see it be falling down. And
well, it wouldn't have been much longer. I can tell you, it would have gone. I'm surprised that South Wall didn't go.
Yeah, and During the 80s, the tourism was on the rise in Skagway, correct?
I remember tourism always being a big factor, even in, back then. In fact, it was hard to get guys to focus because people would be distracted, especially when I had rangers that were working for me. They were able to interpret stuff. You know, people would ask them a question about the building and they'd start into their spiel, you know.
Put down the hammer and start.
Yeah, a lot of that happened.
So, yeah, I didn't think about that. If you were working out in the summer, that you had a lot of foot traffic, people stopped to talk to you guys, what you were doing.
It was just waves of people. And I had a lot of young guys and the young girls would come in and it was like pandemonium for a while. But, it was refreshing, I think, and I didn't mind. You know, I felt if the guy took some time and explained to a tourist or a visitor why we were doing what we were doing, that was good PR for the park.
Yeah.
And I've talked to so many people since I retired that go up there to Skagway. You know, everybody goes on a cruise to Skagway.
Yeah.
I've even thought about it, but I might actually do it one of these days.
Well, I was going to say, have you been back since 1984?
Well, I have not. And I might just go back.
Is there a reason you haven't gone back? I mean, have you been like, don't want to see it?
No,
hasn't happened.
It just hasn't happened. I think that, after my wife passed, it took me a long time to regather myself.
Right.
But, and a lot of what I remember back then involves her.
Right.
And that is, you know, that kind of brings all those memories back, even this does.
Right, yeah.
But
well, hopefully it's some good memories.
Well, it is. And that's, you know, as you get older, that tends to be the way it is.
Right. Well, that's why it's nice to talk about some of the challenges and problems, because it's never all just good.
Mm-hmm. It's like that Jack and Sylvia, the people that adopted us as grandparents. Mm-hmm. That was so cool. I mean, I hadn't been in Alaska a week, and this couple comes up, and they just kind of hung with us and helped us, and then they just disappeared. They were sort of like angels.
Mm.
You know, I don't know what I'd have done without those people, because nobody would babysit. You know, they would help us with the kids. He'd teach me stuff that I needed to know. It's like, I don't know who you are or where you came from, but I'm glad you're here.
Well, and that's a nice example that there was acceptance and help in the community. It wasn't all negative.
Well, these people were from out of the community. I don't know where they were from, Michigan or someplace. They were visitors.
Oh, they were just summer visitors?
They were summer visitors, yeah.
Oh.
For a period of time.
Oh, I thought they were locals.
No, these were people that, Alice Sear, she helped us a lot.
Mm-hmm.
She was very open with us. We spent a lot of time with her. She gave Holly a lot of little dishes.
Was your wife working?
No.
No, she
what did she do? Well, she got involved with the church. She was a really good Catholic until after Skagway. Because the church had its issues too, you know. And I always told her, I says, well, you never really saw the church up close until you got to Alaska. Because everything kind of boils down to its essence up there.
Mm-hmm.
But she struggled up there.
So was that like politics between the powers in the church?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was going to be in charge?
Right. I think they argued about where the podium would go in the church. Things like that.
Well, it's a small town power struggle.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's part of it, too. We weren't used to being in a small town where everybody knows everything, you know, and that's where Not that I made it easy on my wife, because before we moved there, I was in North Denver restoring a house in a really, really rough neighborhood. So Skagway was nothing compared to that.
And did you get married when you were living down in San Diego? Is it?
Yes, I was married before. I was married in the Navy.
Oh, you were?
Yeah, we were married in 70.
And how did you meet?
She wrote me a letter. She worked with my mom, and she wanted to write some sailor. So she wrote me, and I wrote her back, and then next thing you know, we had a great 41 years together.
That's a very romantic, sweet love story.
Yeah, well, she waited for me for two tours of Vietnam.
Yeah.
How many would do that? You know?
But, and she followed you all over.
Yeah.
and helped raise two kids.
Two kids, yeah.
Yeah. What was I just going to say about? Oh, so we see what you were, you know, proud of finishing that project in Skagway. Were there things that you would have liked to stay longer and have accomplished?
Well, if I had stayed, I would have worked on the other buildings that were there. But my sort of, you know, once I moved to Anchorage, I became more of a manager, more mm-hmm. or less, overlooking things. And I really wasn't, you know, when I was in Anchorage, I really wasn't on the boards that much. I would go out and I would talk, you know, like I did a lot of work up in Denali.
Uh-huh.
I did historic structure reports up there. And a lady took me out, sled dog. Boy, that was a lot of work.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I did that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was thinking in Anchorage, you said you went and looked at cabins and stuff. I was wondering, you didn't actually do any of the restoration, that maybe you wrote a report, maybe you didn't even write a report.
Well, I wrote reports, like in Denali, mm-hmm. I wrote historic structure reports. I'm trying to think.
Did any of them get implemented to get restoration?
Well, you know, most of what needed to be done at Denali was kind of minor compared to what Skagway needed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it was a lot of managerial type stuff once I moved up there, and it was, you know, show the flag here, show the flag there kind of thing.
Well, so I can kind of hear it in your voice that you maybe missed being out in the field.
Oh, I loved the field, yeah. I mean, that's, once I went back to Denver, I did some of that again, mm-hmm. you know, and then everything changed when Clinton got in and they outsourced everything.
Oh.
Clinton and Gore, they, you know, we had done since the 1930s done in-house design work, and then all of a sudden they don't want us to do that anymore. They want to outsource everything.
Why?
Well, they think they're going to save money. Mm-hmm. It's a political decision, right. You know, and so that kind of changed stuff. But I got involved in a lot of stuff after Skagway.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Like, what did you do?
I did, a lot of fortifications. I did a lot of work in Boston.
In their historic district?
Yeah, I worked on the USS Constitution Museum. We reutilized a bunch of the structures there. And Allegheny Portage, I worked on that. I worked all over the place. You know, never, the more interesting, you know, I was always kind of a closer. If somebody struggled with a project, I was the guy that came in and finished it. That's what Castillo de San Marcos had been languishing for 20 years. And yeah. I knew the guy that was working on it. I'm not going to say right. who, but they monitored it to death. And I was able to go down, and Pete Tompkins kind of changed from structural engineer to roofing engineer. So Pete and I did that together. It was a lot of fun.
Well, I would think that would make it satisfying to be the closer, because you'd have lots of things that got finished.
Yeah. Plus, I was, you know, I was the boss toward the end, and then if somebody didn't finish it, then I had to finish it.
No.
You know, there was the other thing that made a big change is when we went from hand drawing to CAD drawing.
When did that happen?
Ooh.
Or it should happen over a period of time.
Well, it probably was a period of time, but when I look back, it seemed pretty abrupt. But it was after I came back from Santa Fe, and the service center had a drafting department,
mm-hmm.
but they were really slow, and they used a strange program. So I took it upon myself to learn AutoCAD, and that's where the rest of the industry was going. So I learned it, and a few others learned it, but a lot of others decided they did not want to use CAD drawing. They wanted to do it the old way. And so that was a big problem, and it was a problem until we went to project management. You would have to go in and do their projects for them because they could not draw them on the computer.
And so when did you come from Santa Fe to back to Denver?
It would be 86, I think, is when I left Anchorage, 86, 87, somewhere mm-hmm. around there. I spent about a year in Santa Fe, the guy I was working for was a sexual harasser, and park management didn't want to know about it, and I didn't want to stay with it, so I pulled some connections I had in Denver and got transferred back to Denver.
So around 88?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But I'm just trying to figure out when you went to CAD from hand drawing.
Well, I would have been,
About then.
And then I worked on the Crater Lake Hotel. Did a lot of design work on that. They had an attic that had never been used for anything. I said, yeah, you ought to have two-level rooms. So I did all this great design work. It had a really difficult egress, figured that out. Then they brought an architectural firm in. They took all my drawings and my design and took credit for it.
Oh, no.
But I'll say this. The guy did come back and apologize to me.
I felt better.
But that was kind of the beginning of the end of us doing in-house design work. But so I did a lot of, I did a lot of hotels, a lot of forts. What else?
Historic ranger stations, maybe? Any of those?
Yeah. We did down in Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
I almost went to work at, when we were having a big downsizing, I went out to Yosemite and spent about a month. They really wanted me to move out there, but it was that same kind of thing. They wanted me to come out there and be a member of the park staff. And then it would have been all over again, the same thing I went through in Skagway. There's no place to live, and plus it was really hot. God, it was the hottest place I can ever remember.
Well, it's not in the winter.
No, I'm sure it's not. But El Portel was one of the hottest places yeah. I've ever been. And I thought, no, I couldn't put my family through that again.
Right.
So I stuck with Denver and eventually ended up in a quality assurance group, which was all old codgers like me, and it was fine.
Yeah.
It was a good deal.
So how do you feel about having worked in Skagway?
Oh, I think that was one of my greatest projects, because it was where I learned everything. I had to teach myself, plus I had to teach others, and it was very satisfying from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I just think it's a heck of a resource. The beauty of it was everything was so well preserved.
Yeah.
Even we talk about buildings were ready to fall over, but considering how long they had stood,
Yeah, so it's sort of a unique place in that way within the park system?
Yeah, I think so, because it's so remote and it's so well preserved. I mean, the whole fabric of the town, I compare it like with this historic town here, it's just overrun by contemporary development. And, I could see things that are historic, but that nobody cares. There, I think the townspeople did care about their history. A lot of them were descendants of the gold rushers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's that. I think they were proud of that. And that was part of my thinking when I did stuff. I knew that at some point they would embrace what we were doing. It just was going to take some time.
Right. And they needed the right...
They needed the stimulus.
Right. Or the right
vision.
The right person, I guess.
Well, somebody that was crazy, yeah.
Well, some versus this, the superintendents who wanted to do big stuff, they needed the right person to do it a way that would work on their terms.
Like, here's an example. I think it shows the graphically. We had these vacant lots, and in the springtime, there'd be these great flowers that would come up.
Mm-hmm.
And Dick would go out there and mow them, and he wanted to keep it mowed. And I'm thinking, this is Alaska. This is, these are wildflowers. It was beautiful. When I take you down to show you my railroad downstairs, mm-hmm. I'll show you some pictures of how it looked.
Well, and Skagway... One of the things that it prides itself on is it was the garden city at some point in its past. And that's now come back. There's lots of homes with just beautiful flower gardens.
Yeah.
So having gardens in the empty lots kind of makes sense.
Well, or just letting it be natural, you know. And but that was always kind of the battle. He wanted to have a manicured park, and which was hard for me to understand because I always, you know, even if you're in one of the original parks, you don't manicure those parks.
Right.
You know, the military manicures. You know, you go over to Vietnam and there'd be the headquarters and there'd be a manicured lawn out in front of it with some shell casings and ropes, you know.
Right. Or, you know, a city playground
where
they mow the lawn. I mean, yeah, that's different.
Right. Yeah, we didn't see eye to eye on much of it.
Well, I'm surprised you lasted the 4 years then.
Oh, I'm stubborn, you know. I mean, he tried to push me out. He tried real hard. But I'll say one thing for John Cook. He stood beside me. But there's one anecdotal story that's pretty interesting. He came down there. We would have these back and forths. And so John Cook and Doug Warnock, who was the old ranger, you know, they'd come down there to talk to Dick. And of course, anytime anybody would come to Skagway, he'd take them to Dyea. Mm-hmm. Because that was a place you could go. He took them out there and ran out of gas.
Oh, no.
And I thought, how appropriate. I don't know how they got back, but I thought to myself at the time, I said, now you know what I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
So,
Well, you had mentioned ghost stories. I wanted to circle back to that, if you have any that you want to share.
I had one in the Pineal Mission. I was one night, I got up, I swear to God, I saw somebody sitting next to the window in my bedroom.
Inside
and looking out the window. And there was a window that looked up the up toward the White Pass.
Mm-hmm.
And the weather had been just terrible. And I woke up and I swear I saw this guy sitting there looking up that pass because it had cleared off, you know. And it's just like anything else. Maybe I was dreaming, but boy, it scared the life out of me.
And he was a stampeder type?
Yeah, he was like old guy. You know, and the houses, that, you know, the house that I lived in, the guy kept a record. The historic people that lived there in the old days, he kept a record in pencil on. And they did that a lot. They did that in the railroad depot, too.
Oh, really? On the wall?
Yeah, you would see sketches of sailing ships and stuff. Hmm. Or Heaney, the guy that built the railroad, they didn't like him very much, so they would sketch him and say bad things about him.
What happened to those sketches?
I think we preserved them. Yeah. There may be one that's like got a frame around it or something. Okay. But
so in your house there was that?
Yeah,
kind
there
of...
was. The Gault House had that. It was, like I say, the Gault House was, there was a lot going on there at one time. I think it was a saloon.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just speculation. I don't know for sure, but... I never saw any ghosts there, but when we sold it, the person asked me, and we were having a tough time selling it.
Really?
And I said, sure, I think there is ghosts.
In most places, that would turn people off, but maybe in Skagway,
no,
it was a selling point.
She was looking for a haunted house.
Oh, she was.
Yeah, the only other time in my career I've even had anything like that was at Castillo, when we were putting the Terraplane on. The contractors were complaining that they saw soldiers going in and out of a certain door that's not there anymore.
Wow.
And we went out there and looked, and historically that was the prison part of the fort. So who knows?
What about in the Moore House when you lived there?
I don't remember much there. You know, I think it was pretty rough living there. We weren't there that long.
Yeah.
I do remember the barrel stove glowing red. I didn't realize they would glow red when they got really hot.
Oh, so you almost burned the place down?
Probably. The only time we almost burned one down, and we're not us, but it was the seasonal rangers who were in the Pineal Mission. And they still had that wood stove in there that I had put in there. Or I don't know if I put it in there, if it was there. Anyway, there was a wood stove in there, and they were burning trash.
Oh.
And they got it, I don't know if it was a chimney fire or what, but they got it put out pretty quick. Yeah, we had a few things go on, but I would say, considering the amount of stuff that we did, amazingly, nobody got really hurt or anything, so...
So the Lynch Kennedy, you didn't do any restoration work on it other than just stabilizing it. Right. Okay.
Well, it was a tenuous thing just to do stabilization because it's got a really high false front. And I can remember we had a lift. We could get up pretty high. And when the wind would blow, that front would be like a flag waving.
Oh, my God. And the wind does blow in Skagway.
Mm. Well, I can tell you stories about that, too. I can remember coming on the ferry with my family and getting off the ferry and unable to get to my car because the wind is blowing so hard and you can't even walk against it.
Because it was a north wind coming down?
And we had, or it wasn't that I was necessarily trying to get to my car. I was just going to walk home.
Yeah.
But you couldn't walk in it. It was just so bitter. And we had to have somebody with a car come get us and take us home. That's how it worked.
Right.
It was just, I've never seen anything like that. Because we would get, you know, it was actually a Chinook wind.
Oh.
Because it was 50 below up in the Yukon. So it was only 20 degrees when it got to Skagway, but it was blowing at 60 miles an hour.
Well, it must have been a south wind then, if it was a Chinook.
It was a what?
Would it have been coming from the south?
Well,
off the
it would
ocean?
Come from the north or the south.
Oh, okay.
You get wind either way.
I know, but I was thinking a Chinook being warm would have been coming from the south.
No, Chinook comes from the mountains because it's a Venturi effect.
Okay.
You know, it squeezes between the mountains and it warms up. The same thing happens here in Colorado when the wind comes over.
Well, we get them in Fairbanks, and they're Chinooks because they're bringing the warm in off the mountains. But
yeah, well, it's probably the same thing. It compresses the air.
Yeah.
And, the wind from the south is really worse because it's wet.
Mm.
That's why the admin building suffers so much.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't know, you know.
But with the work crew on the depot building, did weather get in the way?
Yeah, all the time. You know, sometimes it would get so bad we'd have to shut down. Especially when we were digging underneath it, you know. But most of the time, a lot of that digging happened during the summertime, so it wasn't too bad.
So the rain in the summer wasn't a problem?
No, they don't get that much rain. You know, I think they only get about 30 inches of moisture a year. It's mostly just cold wind.
Okay, that's what would shut it down.
Yeah, I would say that I don't remember ever actually shutting down for any long period of time because of weather. Now Sitka, that was a bigger deal down there.
Mm-hmm.
They rained all the time.
Right.
But in Skagway, it was pretty dry most of the time. Just cold.
Right, but so you'd shut down for a day or during a storm or something?
Yeah. I just remember we just put a lot of visqueen up and heated it up. And, you know, we turned the Pantheon into a wood shop, which drove Dick nuts because that's where we got sawdust on the floor. He didn't like that.
And the whole time you were working on the admin building, they kept their offices above the grocery store?
Right.
Yeah, and I'd go back and forth there all day long. And I watch the avocados. They used to think when the avocados got soft, you'd throw them out.
Mm.
No, that's when they'd give them to me for free.
From the grocery store?
They were just ready to eat.
Yeah, that's that fine line of when avocados are...
Well, I can tell you that going up that stair above that grocery store, sometimes the smell could get pretty ripe because they did have stuff going south down there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I can remember when they had pigs in the dump.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They used to have pigs up in the dump, and they never smelled until they took the pigs out of the dump.
So they were pigs used to control the...
I don't know if they were used. They were just there.
No.
But they worked, you know, they were symbiotic with the... and the dump was on fire most of the time.
Yeah.
But those pigs would be up there wallowing in it. And we used to call it Kmart. Because they would take stuff up there and dump it, and sometimes the stuff was still good. And people would rush up there and get food. Anything they
had to fight off the pigs for.
Yeah, the pigs were pretty docile. You know,
and then what happened to the pigs?
I don't know. You know, they probably the state got after them for having them up there. I would think, or maybe somebody thought they were being cruel.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I wonder if they were somebody's personal pigs that they just let roam free.
Probably. I don't know. But yeah. The pigs liked it.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, back in the Gold Rush time, they had pigs and cattle and
yeah, they may have been from the Gold Rush for all I know.
I don't think they probably... Those would be old pigs.
Well, they'd be generational.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this has been great fun. I don't know if there's anything else that you've, you know, when I brought up this idea to do this interview, that certain things you wanted to share and talk
about?
Well,
you know, I think that once you told me about it, a lot of the stuff kind of came back to me as I'm just sitting around and think, oh, yeah, I remember this or I remember that. So, yeah, it's good. Plus, while you were, right when you had contacted me, I was just finishing my streetscape of Skagway in the basement.
So great.
I built train for my grandkid a number of years ago. I was always going to do a streetscape of Skagway. And so I had already started that. And then when you decided to come, I finished it.
All right. Well, good.
And I'll show it to you.
Yeah, I'd like to go see it. Well, thank you very much. I guess we'll turn this off for now.
All right.